You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. This is Guns and Butter.
So the Chechen Wars are part of this Muslim Brotherhood CIA unholy alliance. Most terror organizations today, virtually everyone in Iraq and Syria, most every terrorist so-called jihad organization active is a direct descendant of this CIA Muslim Brotherhood operation that developed a military capability with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 80s.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss the history of the Muslim Brotherhood and its involvement with the CIA. William Engdahl, welcome again.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be with you again, Bonnie.
In your book, The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, an historical overview of the Muslim Brotherhood, or radical political Islam, you begin with a discussion of the Christian Crusades going back over 1,000 years and liken former President George W. Bush's war on terrorism, a modern-day crusade, to the Christian Crusades of the 11th century. What are the similarities? Do they share common goals?
The similarities between the Christian Crusades that began in the 11th century, the late 11th century, and lasted, by the way, for 200 years, and the War on Terror is that the Christian Crusades were various attempts by various popes in Rome to reconquer the Eastern Church that had made a schism, or a great schism, as it's called in the church history, between Rome and the Eastern Orthodox, as we call it today, churches, from Constantinople to Russia to Serbia to Greece. And the split was on a very fundamental issue. There was a doctrine promulgated by St. Augustine, the North African Catholic theologian, and that was the doctrine of original sin, that every life is born into this world a sinner and guilty before God. And the Eastern Church refused that idea vehemently, to the point where they decided to split with the Church of Rome. And for 1,000 years, that has been a fault line between East and West. You can trace it right down to the present day in the frictions between Catholic Western Europe, or Catholic-dominated European Union, and Russia. All of the conflicts against Russia, or against Serbia in the Yugoslav War back in the 80s, or the 90s rather. Or the treatment of Greece in the last 5 years with the financial crisis and the destruction of the Greek nation, the Greek economy. But the war on terror that Bush proclaimed in September 2001 was, in a sense, a crusade, but not quite the way most people would understand it. It was a crusade to create a clash of civilizations, a war between Christian and Muslim, and wars inside Islam itself. to unleash the deepest hatreds and revenge feelings between East and West, Western Christendom and Islam, and also Eastern Orthodoxy. So this is very much what we've seen unfold since 2001. Look at the Arab Spring closely, what I document in my book, The Lost Hegemon. That was an operation to bring a death cult, a Freemasonic-like death cult called the Muslim Brotherhood, by the Obama-Clinton administration when she was Secretary of State, into power throughout the entire Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, was on the hit list of this Arab Spring regime change destabilization from the CIA and the Clinton State Department. So it's very much similar to the Holy Crusades of the Middle Ages. You have slaughter of innocents, looting, wars of unspeakable destruction organized by the West to achieve certain goals, this time for oil, then for control of Palestine, and taking that from the Muslims, and taking that from also from the Eastern Constantinople church. So there are many similarities, but the idea of the crusade, killing heretics for Christ, holy war versus jihad, you know, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux was the patron saint of the crusades. He recruited illiterate peasants from France and all over Europe to join this crusade, and he preached that this was a war. If you kill heretic Muslims, or Saracens, they called them, then you would be saved. You would have a special dispensation from Christ in the church. And, of course, people joined in the hundreds of thousands and looted everything on the way from continental Europe down through the Balkans into Constantinople. Not much different from what Washington is doing in the Middle East today, in Syria, in Libya, and other places.
So would you say that ultimately the goals of both were similar in terms of looting and stealing resources rather than religion?
Very much. Very much. And it's a question of political power, because as long as a different political power with a religious split schism to Rome was in control of the wealth of what today is Turkey, what then is Constantinople and the Eastern Empire, that had to be destroyed. That had to be challenged, as the Vatican and the financial interests behind the Vatican saw.
The Muslim Brotherhood was born in Egypt right after the First World War, according to your book. How did World War I and its aftermath serve as an incubator for the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood emerged out of Egypt in 1926-28, in that period, as a secret society with a public facade of doing good works, service, they call it. And the hidden agenda was a assassin's cult, a military arm of the Brotherhood that uses all means necessary to come to power where possible. And their structure, everything they do, reminds me very much of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, which maybe is not an accident, but be that as it may. So the Brotherhood in Egypt grew up out of the resentment of the betrayal in World War I by the British and by the West, the so-called Christians, of the Muslims, of the Muslim world. Instead of giving the different countries, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and so forth, freedom and independence, which is what the British and the French promised. The British and the French had a secret agreement called Sykes-Picot. At the time, Tsarist Russia was a partner to that, but after the Bolshevik Revolution, they revealed the secrets. The Sykes-Picot divided the entire former lands of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. So Syria, for example, at that point became French, as did Lebanon. Transjordan, or what we know today as Jordan, became a British, and the King of Jordan to this day has ties with the British elites that are very, very deep, to put it mildly. Palestine, what Halford Mackinder, the father of British geopolitics, called the greatest gain of the British Empire in the First World War, Palestine became a League of Nations protectorate of Great Britain, so Britain could control that pivotal area in the whole region, and Iraq became British. Now, the British knew, there's an article I published in my book, A Century of War. I published the picture from this article in May, I believe it was, of 1914, before the First World War, and it was a picture from a British oil magazine of the oil fields of Iraq, or at that point it was Mesopotamia as a province of the Ottoman Empire, and the oil fields of Mosul and all these areas, Kirkuk, were known to British geologists at that time. So this enlisting of the House of Saud, the Bedouins in Saudi Arabia, of the Jordanian and other forces against the Germans and against Ottoman Turkey mainly, was betrayed after the war by the carving up of Sykes-Picot. And that created a huge Arab rage and resentment that the Muslim Brotherhood then channeled into its own political agenda. Most Islam before the 1990s around the world was peaceful, was nonviolent, was non-jihadist. They took their faith as their faith, but didn't force anybody to believe it. But after the 90s, the influence of what I call a marriage made in hell, that is the Muslim Brotherhood, back in the early 50s when the CIA had discovered them, first in Germany, back in the early 50s, they made an assassination attempt against Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And the CIA had to get them out of the country, the leadership of the Brotherhood. And they smuggled them out of Egypt into Saudi Arabia, where the Americans had more or less total control over the royal family. And the deal was that the Muslim Brotherhood would be given support, sanctuary. They would become professors at the religious universities of fundamentalist Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, the most primitive, bestial, I don't know what you want to call it, religion, of the 17th century Bedouin camel herders. And these are the ones that smash statues, that rob the bones out of the grave of the Prophet Muhammad, because graves were a sacrilege in their view. And the rights of women are non-existent because women are simply property of their husbands, their things. So this wonderful humanistic brand of Islam called Wahhabism in the Saudi kingdom was married with the Muslim Brotherhood, which had a political, evangelical recruiting ideology. So Saudi oil money, beginning in the 1950s, began to finance creation of entities like the Muslim World League in Jihad and Riyadh. And the Muslim World League was the missionary arm, like the Mormons or something like that, I guess, the missionary arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, going with Saudi oil money into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, and any place it could get its foot in the door. And that's, by the way, the background of the Mujahideen in the beginning of the 1980s with the CIA against the Soviet Red Army.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Ingdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How was it that Germany in the 30s or the 40s, a Nazi Germany, hooked up with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? How did that happen?
It happened because the Brotherhood came to Berlin. They were on the hit list of the British, who controlled Egypt at that time for various reasons, and were forced into exile. So they went, my enemy's enemy is my friend. They went to Berlin, including the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And then the Nazis realized that the hate that these brothers had against infidels, and infidels for them were communists, they were anybody who didn't follow their line of psychopathy or sociopathy, that could be used as a weapon against the Soviet Union. So they created a division of the SS made up only of Muslim Brotherhood, recruited from the Islamic parts of the Soviet Union, who had many arguments with Stalin's hard-handed policies.
So then did Germany use the Muslim Brotherhood to attack parts of Russia?
Of the Soviet Union, yes, most definitely.
Now, how was that accomplished?
Well, they created a division of the SS, the feared SS, called the Hanchar Division, which was entirely made up of Muslim Brotherhood. They had these special hats that Muslims wore in those days, and then a Nazi swastika on the hats. And then they went at it like the Tatars. You know, these are famed Muslim warriors that sometimes work with Russia, sometimes work against it. But they recruited them, and Himmler said, these Muslims are the most crazy, ferocious fighters we've ever seen. So anyone welcome if they want to kill the communists, as Himmler saw it.
Well, then how did the CIA hook up with the Muslim Brothers?
It happened after the end of the war. The CIA station chief in Munich, Germany, of all places, where Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe were set up by the CIA to broadcast into communist Eastern Europe and the Cold War, they discovered this organization that the Nazis had created, of the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Nazis had created it, and the head of it was in Munich, not in prison, but in Munich after the war, and they contacted him and began to get in contact with his network. And then first they used them as propaganda broadcasters in their native tongues in Chechen and Dagestani and Uzbeki and so forth in the Soviet Union. And then the more they had contact with the mother organization of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt at that time, they brought them to Washington to meet with President Eisenhower. In one case, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna was in this famous meeting. And the CIA took a deeper look at this phenomenon and said, I think we can do business with them. And from that time, the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood have been inseparable. I don't know a better way to describe it.
Well, would you say then that the American CIA have been using the Muslim Brotherhood in the same way that Nazi Germany was employing them?
Very much so. Very much so. You can take, for example, Afghanistan. Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, most people have heard that expression. Mujahideen were supposedly nationalist Afghan fighters who wanted to rid Afghanistan of the Soviet occupation after 1979. An occupation, by the way, which Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, admitted in a French magazine interview years later, was his idea. That he said, if we support these mujahideen in Afghanistan with weapons and so forth, we will provoke a situation where most likely the Soviet Red Army will be forced to intervene to support their pro-Russia government, pro-Soviet government. And at that point, we will demonize the Soviet Union and start a major Vietnam. He called it Russia's Vietnam in Afghanistan. And that's very much what happened. It took 10 years. It was the biggest covert operation to that point in CIA history. And it used Muslim Brotherhood jihadists that Osama and his network out of Saudi Arabia had created. And the interesting point is the man chosen, the person chosen to recruit Islamic jihadists from all over the Islamic world, fanatics, suicidal fanatics, was chosen by the U.S. CIA and by the head of Saudi intelligence, who worked closely with the CIA. And his name was Osama bin Laden. And bin Laden was sent to Pakistan, where he set up a recruitment station, which was called in Arabic, the base, Al-Qaeda. And the base was the data bank of all these Muslim Brotherhoods that Osama's networks had recruited to come and fight the holy war against the infidel Russian soldiers in Afghanistan. It took 10 years and they did it. And then after the collapse of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, when they raised the red flag in 1989, the Soviet Union was virtually collapsed at that point. The CIA flew the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood by covert airline into Azerbaijan, which had declared independence from the Soviet Union and happened to be the site of the Baku oil, the huge oil reserves of the Caspian Sea. And they made a coup d'etat, the Muslim Brotherhood networks made a coup d'etat against the Russian-friendly, let's say, because it was the Russian Federation under Yeltsin, the Russian-friendly leadership in Azerbaijan, to put in a regime that was corrupted by British Petroleum and the American Rockefeller Oil Companies, ARCO and others, to give the oil rights to Baku to the Anglo-Americans, and those oil transports would go not through a Soviet-era pipeline that the Russians had built from Baku up through Chechnya, which was the shortest route, which is a part today of the Russian Federation, up through Chechnya, predominantly Muslim part of Russia, into central Russia and on to the world market. Instead, they created the Chechen War in the 90s to destabilize and destroy that Russian pipeline through Chechnya from Baku, and then made the argument that a pipeline costing vastly, vastly more had to be built from Baku through Azerbaijan, through Georgia, into Turkey, which is a NATO country. And that's more or less what happened. So the Chechen wars are part of this Muslim Brotherhood CIA unholy alliance. Most terror organizations today, virtually everyone in Iraq and Syria, most every terrorist so-called jihad organization active is a direct descendant of this CIA Muslim Brotherhood operation that developed a military capability with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 80s.
I think that what is not very well understood, and you bring it out in the beginning of your book, is that what happened after World War One? I can see from what you write why this Muslim Brotherhood would have been created in the first place. It's because of the horrible way the Arabs were treated by Britain particularly, but by the Allies after World War One.
Very much, because you have to have a rage to recruit to a death cult. You can't just recruit people who are fat and happy, whatever you want to call. You know, you have to have rage. You have to have something that you can organize and direct to give it expression. And the rage was at the British betrayal, the Balfour Declaration, which opened Palestine essentially to Jewish settlement that would push out the Palestinians and the Arabs. So that was one betrayal. That was 1916, before the end of the war. The other was Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, British intelligence, who became Arab, quote-unquote. He befriended Ibn Saud, the great founder of the House of Saud, the Saud dynasty. And after the war, he said, I risked the fraud on my conviction that Arab help was necessary to our cheap and speedy victory in the East. Better we win and break our word than lose. And he was the one guiding the Arabs to war against Ottoman Turkey and the British, because the British aim in the Great War was to control the oil riches of the Middle East. The British Navy had, at the beginning or shortly before the war, made a decision to convert the entire Royal Navy, the heart of power of the military projection of the British Empire, from coal to oil. But to have oil, the North Sea wasn't known at that time, to have oil to feed the fleet, they had to have secure supply sources, which meant Kuwait, which meant Saudi Arabia, although that the oil riches there were discovered later, and it meant Iran, where Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later called British Petroleum, was first created. So to control that, they had to control the Middle East, and that's what much of that war was all about.
And, of course, in your book, you talk about how the British had enlisted the help of the Arabs to overthrow the Ottomans and then, of course, turned around and stabbed them in the back with the settlements after World War One. What I thought was quite interesting is that you talked in your book, The Lost Hegemon, about how the British were bringing down the Ottoman Empire by saddling them with debt. And that certainly is what's happening today and ever since with the IMF and the World Bank, etc.
It's the model. It's the model. If you look closely at what the British and French banks did at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the period leading up to World War One, they took the Ottoman Empire, they gave them loans under friendly conditions. It's always the honey trap. And the Sultan needed money, hard currency money, to, you know, to build up his economy, to build up the empire. And then the debt became so much that it was impossible for them to repay. So it's kind of like the model of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, today. So in order to repay the creditor banks of France and the City of London, the creditors established something called the Public Debt Administration. It's a little bit like the Dawes plan or the Versailles debt collection plan that was imposed on Germany after World War One. But the Public Debt Administration was totally controlling all the finance ministry revenues and had first claim on those revenues. And, you know, the empire was simply being bled under debt slavery through that.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Ingdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And then again, of course, in order to repay the debt, the Ottomans, the Turks, had to change the way they did business with the rest of their empire so that they had to crack down on everybody. And then it created this resentment against Turkey. And so that's obviously why the Arabs were willing to ally with the British during World War One.
Precisely. I More than 30 years ago, I was living in New York working as a journalist, and I was researching this period of World War I, and I was in the New York Public Library, and I found documents about British Finance Ministry plans before the war for the carving up of the Ottoman Empire to repay those debts. So this was planned very, very well in advance.
Yeah, that's amazing. These things are so well planned in advance.
The patriarchs or oligarchs or whatever name you want to call these silly people, they have a nose like a beagle for money and where to steal it.
Since we're talking about the history of the Ottoman Empire and, of course, specifically Turkey, could you talk about Fethullah Gulen's worldwide Islamic movement based in Salersburg, Pennsylvania?
Salersburg, Pennsylvania, if you know anything about Pennsylvania, and I've been there quite often, is not exactly what you would think of as the headquarters of a worldwide Islamic terrorist organization. But since 1998, when Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish political cult leader, was forced into exile by the Turkish government for preaching essentially sedition and treason against the Turkish state and institutions, he has been based in Salersburg, Pennsylvania. And he got his base there through the CIA, through a man named Graham Fuller, and the former ambassador to the Ankara, to Turkey, as well as another CIA very senior figure, against the objections, interestingly, of the U.S. State Department, who said Fethullah Gulen is no religious scholar. He has no claim on a special academic scholar visa. He has a fifth grade education, and it's said that he has a worldwide empire worth billions that are financed in part by drug money. And the fact that the CIA was responsible to get Fethullah Gulen his residency in Salersburg, Pennsylvania, is very much proof that he is an asset of the CIA. He was picked up in right-wing neo-Nazi Turkish networks that the Gladio NATO had created back in the 70s and the 80s in Turkey and all NATO countries. And then he was remodeled, if you want to use the term, into a moderate Islamic scholar, something he never was and never will be, in my view. And he was called Imam, but he's no Imam. He even renounced the title. It means teacher. But it sounded very holy at the time. And on his website, he talks about the Sufi tradition of moderate Islam. He even made a photo opportunity with Pope John Paul II before his death that he predominantly displays on his website. So people say, oh, this is really a man of multicultural understanding and inclusiveness and so forth. That's the cover. In reality, Gulen worked with the CIA to set up madrasas immediately when the Soviet Union collapsed. The Gulen organization went in with a lot of money, believed to be, keep in mind, from the drug trade. They went into the entire Turkic belt, which historically goes from Turkey up through into the western part of China called Xinjiang province, where the Uyghurs, the Turkic Uyghurs, who call themselves East Turkestan, by the way. So this whole belt of Islam from Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, on down to Turkey was being opened, and suddenly Fethullah Gulen's organization began setting up schools with teachers. And in one case, according to the former head of the Turkish CIA, a nationalist, there were 500 CIA agents in Gulen schools in the former Soviet Union who were listed as native-speaking English teachers, and they all carried diplomatic passports. Well, I used to be a native-speaking English teacher years ago, and no one offered me a diplomatic passport. They were CIA agents. And that's what this former head of Turkish intelligence described in his memoirs. So Gulen not only was active in the former Soviet Union, trying to create Islamic chaos and agitation, but his main focus was in Turkey. And there, he made a deal with the man who's to become prime minister and most recently president of Turkey, Recep Erdogan. And the deal was the then very influential organization of Fethullah Gulen called SEMAT in Turkish, or service, would give its support, its base, to support the AK party, the AKP of Erdogan in the elections and get them into power. But in return, Gulen's people demanded free rein to control the education ministry of Turkey, to control appointments of judges in the judiciary in Turkey, and the national police as well, it turns out, in the aftermath of the failed coup d'etat of July by Gulen's people, the army, the heart of the Atatürk secular Turkey from the end of World War I. And what they were about was essentially a CIA-directed takeover of the Turkish state. And at a certain point, not a case of good guy versus bad guy, but at a certain point, Erdogan, who's very jealous of his power, realized that Gulen wanted to take control over everything. He wanted control of the Turkish CIA, the MIT. And that was in 2013. So there came this confrontation over a park in Istanbul, a historic park, where the Erdogan government wanted to construct a modern shopping plaza, shopping mall. And Gulen opposed Erdogan at this point, but the real issue was this control of the CIA in Turkey. So from that point on, there was this open split. Now, in July of this year, July 15th, in fact, there was a attempted coup d'etat against the Erdogan rule in Turkey. Keep in mind, Erdogan is no saint. His focus is power, the power of Erdogan. But his focus is the power of Erdogan. He's very concentrated on that. And he realized that a coup d'etat was being launched, and he was told, according to various reports, by Russian intelligence through Iranian or other intermediaries, that within a few hours, his resort hotel, where he was on holiday with his family, would be invaded by coup helicopters, and he would be taken prisoner and shot. And he fled to another location and managed to broadcast to the nation the broadcast saying, Turkish people, take to the streets to defend your country against the CIA coup d'etat led by Fethullah Gulen. And that happened. I mean, that's a matter of record. Some people say this was a fake attempt by Erdogan. I don't think it was. I think it was genuine. And Graham Fuller, the mentor of Fethullah Gulen, was in Istanbul on an island at a conference 20 minutes boat ride away from the center of Istanbul on the night of the coup d'etat. So this was very much a CIA-sponsored attempt, and it happened weeks after Erdogan made a 180-degree foreign policy shift away from the NATO line against Assad in Syria and against Russia by shooting down the Russian jet. And he realized that he had been trapped in a dead-end corner, and he began making overtures toward reconciliation with Putin and with China. And to the surprise of the West, Russia began a back-channel dialogue that led to a reopening of relations. And when that happened, the CIA went into high-speed panic. And I think that is the background of the attempted coup d'etat.
I remember that some people were trying to claim that Erdogan had staged the coup himself and that it was all fake. But in your opinion, it was a real coup, and the Russians actually tipped off Erdogan, right?
Well, if that had not happened and Erdogan had been captured and murdered, the coup would have succeeded. It wasn't a completely amateurish attempt at all. So, and the fact that Graham E. Fuller and a CIA colleague of his, Henry Markey, who, by the way, is or was a professor at a university 20 minutes car drive from the compound of Fethullah Gulen in Salisbury, Pennsylvania. Interesting. They were having a CIA conference on the night of the coup. In other words, monitoring the whole process. That's not a coincidence, I don't think. And both Graham E. Fuller and Henry Markey made vehement denunciations of charges that they were involved in the coup. Well, a CIA leading figure like Graham E. Fuller, who's architect of the Iran-Contra scam and various other things, and the patron of Fethullah Gulen, you don't go public and deny anything because it says, methinks thou doth protest too much, Mr. Fuller. He did the same thing with the Boston Massacre, where the two patsies for the Boston Massacre, so-called, the Boston Marathon bombing, were nephews of the son-in-law of Graham E. Fuller, who married Fuller's daughter. So this is a very tight-knit little intimate network of nastiness, I think. And the CIA was involved in it. And that, when this came out about the son-in-law of Graham Fuller being the uncle of these two kids, Graham Fuller held a press conference to deny any connection to this. Again, you know, the man has so much blood on his hands, he can't help but say, I'm guilty, I'm guilty, I'm guilty. By claiming he's innocent, he's innocent, he's innocent.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Ingdahl. Today's show, The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Is there a relationship between the international Gulen movement and the Muslim Brotherhood?
The Gulen movement is the Muslim Brotherhood in the Turkish world. The Turkic people are not Arabs. The Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni Arab. So the Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood is the Gulen movement, essentially. Sunni, pro-death cult, but Turkic. So you couldn't have an al-Baghdadi fictional leader of the Turkish Islamic movement. You had to have a Turk. Because they're very nationalistic, very ethnically oriented.
Let's bring the Muslim Brotherhood up to date in present time with regard to ISIS, for instance. How did ISIS, or the Islamic State, develop out of al-Qaeda and the Mujahideen?
The al-Qaeda, which grew up, as I said earlier, in Pakistan to fight this Mujahideen holy war against the Soviet Red Army throughout the 1980s, Osama bin Laden's organization, they were flown or transported by the CIA, the leadership, into former Soviet Union and into Bosnia-Herzegovina and the U.S. breakup of what was called Yugoslavia back in the early 90s. And then they, because they were Arabs, they were predominantly Arabs recruited by Osama, in the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. in 2003, they were brought into Iraq, and General David Petraeus was instrumental in working with the Sunni networks to get this hatred stirred up that was connected with the Muslim Brotherhood and Sunni against Shia. And so there was Al-Qaeda in Iraq that was established, and soon it transformed into an affiliate in Syria called Al-Qaeda in Syria, and then it became Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. And then at a certain point, the CIA decided to change the name. They trained these cadre in a secret NATO base in Turkey, among other places, and also in Jordan. They needed a new organization to continue the war against Bashar al-Assad. So they called it the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS. And then someone pointed out, some Israeli journalists, that ISIS is another abbreviation for the Israeli Mossad, so that might not be too good an abbreviation, so they called it the Islamic State. But it's a U.S. Mossad and Turkish intelligence operation with money from Saudi Arabia and from Qatar, Kuwait, perhaps also the Emirates, certainly, but Qatar, where the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood sits presently. And it's about oil and gas war pipelines, pipeline wars, because Syria refused in 2009 to let Qatar run a gas pipeline from Qatar's huge gas field in the Persian Gulf through Syria into Turkey and onto the European Union, the huge gas market consumers over the next 20 years in the world. So in a sense, this very much is a war in Syria or over Syria about control of pipelines for energy.
You write in The Lost Hegemon that behind every Arab Spring regime change from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya and later to Syria, one organization invariably emerged out of the shadows to push aside the poorly organized democratic protesters and to take center stage. That organization was the Muslim Brotherhood. How much of the Arab Spring do you think was orchestrated by the U.S.?
All of it. Every single bit of it. I've detailed this in my writings and in my books.
But now, how do you square that with democratic protesters? I mean, probably most of the people demonstrating in these countries had very real aspirations. They weren't all just puppets of the CIA.
Of course not. Otherwise, these things wouldn't work. The CIA created something in 1983. Bill Casey was Reagan's head of CIA, and George Bush, the vice president, former director of CIA, worked on this, called the National Endowment for Democracy. And the idea was to have NGOs, so-called private NGOs, not traceable directly to the CIA, to do these destabilizations. And they would do it under the name of democracy. And they would bring to Washington or bring to Belgrade, where CANVAS, the organization that came out of the regime change destabilization of Milosevic in the 1990s in Serbia, they would train certain pre-picked student activist leader types and send them back to lead essentially color revolutions in these countries. So this was done in China in the Tiananmen Square operation of Bush Sr. with the CIA in 1989. You get hundreds of thousands of students and you profile them psychologically what the issue is that they'll respond to. I know students who were active in the Egyptian color revolution. They believed that this was genuine, spontaneous grassroots. That's the purpose of the whole thing, to make it that. But the reality is, what happened after the collapse of Mubarak? Those students and their democratic, lovely thoughts vanished, and the Muslim Brotherhood, they took over, not the students.
But then Morsi was overthrown by, what's his name, al-Sisi?
Al-Sisi, yeah, the military, essentially, because the military realized that what was on the agenda would take away all their power. Al-Sisi, ironically, was supported by the Saudi government, because the Saudis realized the Muslim Brotherhood of Obama and Hillary Clinton was aimed at Saudi Arabia as well. They were starting to get very active inside Saudi Arabia. So rather than let Morsi and the Muslim Brothers establish a launching base in Egypt, they financed al-Sisi to make essentially a coup d'etat, although they don't like to call it that. But the students, in every case, there's a man named Gene Sharp. He's deceased now, but he was in Boston and created something that worked with the CIA and the Pentagon since 1983 called the Albert Einstein Institution. And he did a years-long study of, by the way, the name of the Albert Einstein had nothing to do with the scientist. It just, he confessed years later that it sounded serious, so he took it. He studied nonviolent revolutions from Gandhi and so forth, and said this can be a weapon that the U.S. government can use for regime change. And give credit where credit is due, he was a clever guy. He put it into a handbook of ABCs that was then translated into the languages of every country that had these color revolutions. One of the key points was to make a monkey out of the ruling dictatorship, and that's usually fairly easy to do, but you do it through social media and other things. And then once you do that, you get the population on your side and you build it into a complete regime change like you had against Mubarak in Egypt.
What I don't understand about the CIA or the U.S. being behind these color revolutions, and I'm not referring to the Ukraine here or Eastern Europe or anything like that, but in the Arab world, what would have been the point of getting rid of Mubarak or the head of Tunisia? And, of course, Gaddafi, etc. It all seems fairly crazy to me. It didn't work out for them at all, did it?
No, it didn't. Most of these things don't work out for them. They're a little bit stupid. But that's my personal opinion. But the triangle that you mentioned, Mubarak in Egypt, Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia, they were all dictators, no question about it. But these are dictatorial cultures. Gaddafi in Libya was chosen by the tribal elders in a process that took 15 years for them to come to a consensus before he became the supreme leader of Libya. But the three of those countries, and this came out in emails that WikiLeaks released from Hillary Clinton, those three countries in particular were about to launch something called the Golden Dinar Islamic Bank, Central Bank, and that the oil, especially of Libya, would be sold on the world market only in exchange for golden dinar, not for dollars. And if the idea of this gold-backed currency were to spread throughout the oil-rich Muslim world, Arab world, this would have been catastrophe for the U.S. dollar.
Yes, that's right. I remember all of that now. That makes a total sense.
But there's, you know, there's more to it. It's simply, for example, Syria has some of the largest oil reserves in the world that are undeveloped. Syria has huge natural gas reserves that are undeveloped. So if those reserves get linked to a triangle called Iran and Russia and China, that's a huge disadvantage for the Anglo-American oil power. So all of these things kind of came into play, and the idea of Dick Cheney's London 1999 speech to the Institute of Petroleum is the problem of these countries in the Middle East, where all the oil reserves are, and today you would say gas reserves also, is that the energy companies are in state ownership and not private. Private meaning ExxonMobil. Private meaning British Petroleum. Private meaning Chevron. Private meaning Shell. So I think that's also what the Arab Spring is all about.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. I very much enjoyed another chat with you. And I hope your listeners also. And thank you again.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been The Lost Hegemon, How the CIA Lost Its Holy War Crusade. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter with significant content. He is launching a new monthly subscription audio seminar. That's WilliamEngdahl.com, William ENGDAHL. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
up next.
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. In the holiday spirit, we present Almost Complete and Almost Uncut, Scooter's Satiric Collage, The War on Christmas Kickstarter. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last year, about this time, we broadcast an installment titled Dispatches from the War on Christmas. That show included about 10 minutes of an audio collage on the same theme by Scooter. Scooter produces a satiric radio program, The Inner Side, down at KPFT-FM in Houston. You may recall one part we broadcast, a funny war movie parody which ends with Alvin and the Chipmunks getting machine-gunned to death by enemy forces. Well, I recall it. I think that Scooter's collage is worth hearing in its entirety, and today we shall hear almost all of it, almost uncut and almost unabridged. In addition to the Chipmunk Massacre, the piece has parts of a debate on religion in America. The debate is between that most articulate pundit and, incidentally, atheist, the late Christopher Hitchens, and a guy named Bill Donahue. Donahue sees the Roman Catholic Church as under attack by the evil forces of secular humanism. Hitchens makes short work of him. And the collage includes much, much more, including a couple of Christmas carols in the musical style technically known as heavy metal. The War on Christmas Kickstarter. Kickstarter is now an obscure metaphor based on obsolete technology, a term of obscure origin and perhaps vague meaning to you youngins, like fast forward and the flip side. I'm old enough to have owned and operated actual Kickstarters, as well as fast-forward buttons and discs that had a flip side. Well, from hour to hour we ripe and ripe, and hour to hour we rot and rot, and thereby hangs a tale. But let us turn from Shakespeare to the War on Christmas Kickstarter. I hope you'll get a kick out of it.
It's that time of year. We've pooped out the last of that Thanksgiving turkey. And you know what that means, my precious godless heathens. Time to gather up your pentagrams, dead babies, and evil, satanic Harry Potter action figures. Because the truce is over. Tonight, the eternal War on Christmas resumes.
Celebrate the horror of Christmas with the most violent holiday special ever.
Gee, this is awful, Dad. Car's loaded on dope and he's killing people.
Tell it to the Xmas bunny, kid.
Cute, isn't it? Santa Claus bringing for Christmas? I got a fire engine.
Listen, Mug. Do you know who I am?
Now, don't tell me. Are you animal or vegetable? Animal.
All aboard!
We are free and fairly sober with so many toys to build. The machines are kind of tricky, probably someone will be killed. But we gladly work for nothing,
which is good because we don't intend to pay.
The elves are back to work today. Hooray! We have just a couple hours to make several billion gifts, and the labor isn't easy.
When you're low on triple shifts, you can make the
Selfish little bastards, do you want the kids to think that Santa's just a clumsy, empty-handed jerk?
Yeah!
Then shut your yaps and back to work.
Silent night, holy night, lost asleep, one so light, just the faithful and holy pair. Lovely boy child with curly hair, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace.
My mother must have gotten a Miss Shields. There could be no other explanation.
Yo, Shantiraya! Yo, Shantiraya!
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho.
Okay, well, what else is there to tell? Not much, you know. I don't know where to start with the rest of it. Which is probably for the best, because I don't know when to stop, either. It's, you know, it's like, beat a dead horse. Hell, I'll nuke this son of a bitch and then complain because the meat is overdone.
And American retailers really rely on it for the bulk of their earnings.
Your anti-Christmas.
It was a war on Christmas to sell everything, from Coca-Cola to electric shavers. It goes on and on.
The war.
Happy reunion between tradition, war faith, war business, and just war fun. War is Santa making a comeback. War. War. Christmas time is a lot of fun.
War.
War on Christmas. The true meaning of Christmas is Christ's birthday.
War. War. War.
Christ's birthday.
Secular progressives.
Why Christmas matters.
War.
War. War.
That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points Memo.
War.
Under assault by secular progressives. They want a new America.
War.
And inclusive America.
Secular progressives don't want Christmas because that stands in the way of legalized drugs, euthanasia, gay marriage,
What about the movie Dogma, also coming out from Miramax? You're not going to see a movie about Kadesh. You're not going to see a movie where they're going to use toilet humor with the Jews. That's because Jews have done a better job than Catholics have in fighting back. Catholics are a little slow to react. Now, the public sector, that's what I want to talk about. The public sector actually subsidizes anti-Catholicism in this country. You wouldn't have the Rockefeller Foundation subsidizing Jews for Jesus, but you have the Ford Foundation subsidizing Catholics for a free choice, which was condemned by the Catholic Church in 1993. The nonprofits, you have Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, dressed like nuns. People say, well, they give money to charities. How about a bunch of white boys setting up the Al Jolson Society with a little black paint on the face, doing a little tap dance and saying, well, we give to charities. In terms of the public theaters, Manhattan Theater Club, the museums, the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Let's listen to the reaction here. Boxes of maggots, decomposing cow's heads, bisected pig in formaldehyde, and the Holy Virgin Mary by Christopoulos. Where did this come from? Well, it came from England. There are two things about England that I know that we've had to put up with. One of them is Christopher Hitchens, and the other is elephant dung. You may need this, too. After listening to him, I brought along some of my vomit bags. Now, we used that very successfully in the Brooklyn Museum of Art. So if anybody feels the need to puke, there you have. Now, you also have a problem with the state schools in this country. Penn State, for example, feminist fascists there made a vagina with human hair and then put our Blessed Mother inside of it to show how much they care about us. At Hunter College, another state-supported institution, you had Condom Jesus, and at SUNY New Paltz, the same kind of outrage.
Now, it could be that when religion is attacked in this country, that the Catholic Church comes in for a little more than its fair share. But doesn't the Catholic Church make rather large claims for itself? The Catholic Church claims to hold the keys of Peter. The Holy Father claims to have that power and to be the vicar of Christ upon earth. It is said that only through this means and this approach can redemption be achieved. These are large claims for a human and fallible and political and bureaucratic institution to be making for itself in the age of Hawking. I think it's also the case that America is preeminently a country of, if not sexual license, a country of sexual tolerance, a country of sexual pluralism for now. Well, Holy Mother Church doesn't settle for that. Holy Mother Church makes rather strict demands. Holy Mother Church prohibits, by various edicts, ukases, statutes, and pronouncements, all forms of sex that are not specifically devoted to the outcome of procreating further Catholics, and it enforces this with a celibate hierarchy. Now, that's fine, and it is your choice, and as you say, no one has to join that church, but that church, where it can, does try and impose those standards on non-believers and non-members. And should it not be believed, or at least affirmed, or at any rate not repudiated, that you should expect to suffer for this? That you should be proud to be abused? That you will be told that what you believe is absurd? That you should be glad to hear it for his sake? And isn't that a rather dignified position? A rather honorable position for the church to take? But instead, what do we get? An endless whine of self-pity. Why are they picking on us? They wouldn't say that about the Jews. An endless play on the ethnic politics and identity politics card. An endless appeal to self-pity, where you should be proud that you're in a fight for your politics and your church. And you seem instead to be resentful about it, and perhaps, who knows, a little insecure. However, for the main part of it, you only have to open a paper to see the exaggerated deference paid to every utterance of His Holiness the Pope, wherever he goes, and the extraordinary deference shown to him whenever he visits these shores and decides to grace us with his presence. As I say, I have only a minute to go, and I don't want to overrun my time or end foaming in mid-sentence, waving vomit bags and Tampax in the name of good taste and good bearing and good manners and good standards. I think I can hope to be rescued from that fate without any divine intercession. The truth of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, brothers and sisters, religion has it very much its own way in this country of ours. It's in the Pledge of Allegiance, thanks to a stupid intervention by President Eisenhower. It's on the money. It's in the opening of Congress every day. It's at the National Prayer Breakfast. It's when the delinquent president summons his advisors and his spiritual team in order to fend off what should have been inevitable. And it's high time that that situation was reversed and we developed a proper immunity to it and made sure that religion could only be self-inflicted. Thank you. Bring us a figgy pudding, so bring us a figgy pudding. Bring us a figgy pudding and a cup of good cheer. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. So bring it out here.
Say that Calcutta needs population control. But on the page before, you actually say that secular leftist politics predominates. Didn't you quite figure out the cause and effect? Didn't you quite figure out that the reason they have so much poverty over there is precisely because of your secular leftist politics which predominates? Where in God's name has socialism ever delivered anything but what Orwell said?
leader worship, oppression, and war. That's the legacy of what you stand for.
Everybody knows that there is one way, that, and only one way, by which poverty can be cured. It involves the empowerment of women. Go to a village in Bolivia and Bangladesh, anywhere you like, any wooden spoon country you choose. Give women some power and education where their reproduction and reproductive rate is concerned, and come back a year or two later, and you will see the floor has moved up a little bit away from the swamp of ignorance and filth and superstition and infant mortality and disease, and things are starting to happen. And then if you can come up with maybe a handful of seeds in a small loan, things will really start to happen. But it all depends on releasing women from their dependence on the cycle of reproduction and on the husbands who force it on them and the conditions that force it on them.
She's to be examined and executed by Joseph.
And lords are leaping.
And the community on the spot. What would be the natural... Knew she was going to be killed if her condition became known.
Six geese are laying.
It would be fear. It would be regret. It would be... It would be sorrow. It would be shame. There would be tears. There would be secrecy. There would be seclusion. She would run and hide and try to save her life. So what did Mary do?
It's been a war on Christmas. War on Christmas.
She ran, all right. She ran straight to the house of another woman.
And was a leaping.
Christmas. There is a war on Christmas.
Your auntie was a war on Christmas.
And then all the community would join in until Mary was born.
War. Secular progressives don't want Christmas because that stands in the way of
at ease, gentlemen. Welcome to the new cavalry. We will ride in battle.
All right, you chipmunks. Ready to sing your song?
I'll say we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
This is Norton Scooter Presents, a Norton Scooter production. With me, your host, Norton Scooter, reporting from the surge, or the bulge, or the escalation, or... whatever the kids are calling it these days.
You don't have to catch it. You don't have to beat it. But I can assure you, out of the plane.
And as you can probably tell from what's going on behind me, the war on Christmas has been fully mobilized.
They got Theodore.
Over here! Over here! Find the piano! I can't see! I can't feel my tail!
Come on. Come on, we're gonna make it. Come on, don't give up. No! No! Gone without me. It's too late. Oh, Simon. Simon. Oh, oh, God, look at you. Oh, they got me.
No rest. No peace.
Great. Gosh.
Ah, yes. 500,000 mobile phones are going to be sold in December alone. Awful lot of talking going on over Christmas about loving.
Season's greetings.
Brings the Christmas into the summer picture, doesn't it?
Silent night, holy night, with lot.
Mm-hmm. So what are you saying? Bill, I'm going to have to wind you up here because we've got the news coming fast at one. Yeah. In 5 words, what are you saying?
What are you saying?
M25 is still rather hazardous, even though...
No, we seem to... Hank, can I just stop you for a second or two? Because we seem to have just a wee bit of a problem there hearing you. Are you switched on as you should be?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, well, you sound very, very distant to me just at the moment. I don't know what we can do about that. We can have just one more go at it. We've got all the buttons pressed in the right place here. And apologies for that.
Christmas is coming.
What are you saying?
Let's get ready for the festive season together with a difference.
What a performance.
Bright sunshine, one moment, we're told.
Because he read it in the Old Testament, which is the book of my people, the Jewish people. And that book wasn't good enough for you Christians. Was it? You went, no, we've got a better book with a better character. You're going to love him. And you called your book new and said our book was old. And yet every Sunday, I turn on the television set. And there's a priest or a pastor reading from my book. And interpreting it. And their interpretations, I have to tell you, are usually wrong. It's not their fault, because it's not their book. You never see a rabbi on TV interpreting the New Testament, do you? If you want, to truly understand the Old Testament if there's something you don't quite get. There are Jews who walk among you. And they, I promise you this, will take time out of their day and interpret for you anything that you're having trouble understanding, and we will do that.
And of course they have those channels that are religious to talk about Jesus, and that's one of those things that, you know, I wish they would understand that people basically, I think, know who Jesus is. Maybe I'm guessing, maybe I'm way out of line here, but I have a good feeling that generally Americans and the people throughout the world know who Jesus is. So it's a little frustrating to keep hearing about how that, you know, we need your dollars, we need your help, because we want people to know who Jesus is. Hey, we know who Jesus is. Get a job.
Comedians Lewis Black and Sam Kinison at the end there. We heard almost the entirety of the War on Christmas Kickstarter, thanks to its creator, Scooter. You'll find more of Scooter's stuff at accessofevil.org. That's spelled A-K-S-I-S, accessofevil.org. And you'll find much more of our stuff at our own website, namely newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes, and advising illegitimi non carborundum, hoping you'll come back again next week, and wishing you the best of this Christmas season. Peace.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. The truth, just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth, just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
The focus of today's show will be government officials who can't keep the 9/11 story straight, and fake news. 9/11 is more important today than ever, and is still being used as the justification for the continuing fraudulent global war on terror, and the frightening crackdown on our civil liberties everywhere, not just in the U.S. It's the convenient excuse given by the U.S. and its allies to invade and occupy any country in the world. And conveniently, many of these countries just happen to have coveted natural resources or land. So exposing the truth about 9/11 seems to be the only way to stop these illegal wars of occupation and the death and destruction they bring to innocent people in other countries, and also to our own soldiers who bravely go into these wars believing that they are protecting their country not realizing that they are being manipulated by their own government to further the Project for a New American Century agenda of full-spectrum dominance by the U.S. of the world, and at the same time enriching many in the arms and banking industries in the process. Sometimes the elite themselves have trouble keeping the reality and the lies straight, and they slip and say some pretty revealing things. On today's show, I'm going to share with you 8 examples of this. So let's begin with the first blooper by blooper-in-chief, former President George W. Bush, who was president when 9/11 happened. These first few examples that you're about to hear are about the World Trade Center buildings. Now remember, the official government story, as told by the government, the 9/11 Commission report, and repeated, unchallenged, by the controlled corporate and much of the supposed alternative media, is that the Twin Towers collapsed due to fires generated by the planes hitting the Twin Towers, and that World Trade Center Building 7 was brought down by fires that spread from the Twin Towers. And here he is, former President George W. Bush.
As soon as Congress acts on this bill, the men our intelligence agencies believed helped orchestrate the 9/11 attacks can face justice. The bill would also provide clear rules for our personnel involved in detaining and questioning captured terrorists. The information that the Central Intelligence Agency has obtained by questioning men like Khalaik Sheikh Mohammed has provided valuable information and has helped disrupt terrorist plots, including strikes within the United States. For example, Khalaik Sheikh Mohammed described the design of planned attacks on buildings inside the U.S. and how operatives were directed to carry him out. That is valuable information for those of us who have the responsibility to protect the American people. He told us the operatives had been instructed to ensure that the explosives went off at a point that was high enough to prevent people trapped above from escaping. That the explosives went off at a point that was high enough to prevent people trapped above from escaping.
So there you have it, Bush talking about bombs in the World Trade Centers. And of course, as many of you already know, Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA. You also know that the anthrax scare came from U.S. military and corporate sources, and that many, if not all, of the other domestic plots that Bush refers to were orchestrated by the FBI, entrapping poor and sometimes mentally challenged individuals with thousands of dollars. And don't take my word for it. It's been well documented by some mainstream news sources like Rolling Stone magazine and Fox News. And while you're at it, if you're really curious, look up Operation Gladio, and you'll learn that this isn't the first time this behavior has been used by our wonderful leaders. And now the next clip you're going to hear is a British member of Parliament making the same error that former President Bush made, talking about bombs going off in the World Trade Center towers. So here he is.
And it's worth remembering why we're here, why we're fighting, what this is all about. This is not a war of choice. It is a war of necessity. This is not a war of occupation. It's a war of obligation. On 9/11, when the Twin Towers were blown up, and so many British people died, as well as Americans.
Did you catch that? Let's hear it again.
On 9/11, when the Twin Towers were blown up, almost every single person that took part in that attack was trained here in Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda. That's why we came here. That's why we cleared away those training camps. And if we left tomorrow, those training camps could come back tomorrow.
Well, unfortunately, it looks like the only truth this British MP told was actually the blooper remark about the bombs in the Twin Towers. And now here's the current U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, slipping up and actually revealing a little bit of 9/11 truth about the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane on 9/11.
Also, a question I had for you. World Trade Center 7 was brought down on September 11th at 5:20 in the evening. The leaseholder of the World Trade Center complex, Larry Silverstein, gave a public interview on PBS in 2002, and he said that they pulled that building, which is a demolition term for intentionally bringing down a building. This man made over $5 billion from those buildings' destruction. And I want to know if there was ever a formal investigation into Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder of the World Trade Center complex, and his ties to this entire event.
I don't believe there's been a formal investigation. I haven't heard that. I don't know that. I do know that that wall, I remember, was in danger, and I think that they made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things, that they did it in a controlled fashion.
And let's hear that again.
That wall, I remember, was in danger, and I think that they made a decision based on the danger that it had of destroying other things, that they did it in a controlled fashion.
Of course, when the 2,700-plus members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth provide the scientific evidence proving the collapse of World Trade Center 7 by controlled demolition, they're called conspiracy theorists. John Kerry, of course, doesn't elaborate on who would have had access to World Trade Center 7 to wire it for controlled demolition. And since World Trade Center 7 housed the CIA, the Security and Exchange Commission, and other federal agencies, is it really likely that Al-Qaeda would have had access to this building for the extended period of time needed to wire it for controlled demolition? Well, let's move on to another George W. Bush slip-up. This time he's talking about the planes.
And you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to wonder exactly what President George W. Bush knew about the attack and when he knew it. According to the official White House version, it was at this moment in a Florida classroom that Bush learned the second plane had hit the World Trade Center and that the U.S. was under attack. But here's what George Bush himself said almost 3 months later when asked about September 11th.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it.
Now, wait a minute. George Bush was told about the second plane while he was inside the classroom. So you just heard him describe seeing the first plane crash on television that day. But that's impossible. No one saw the first plane crash on TV on September the 11th because the videotape of it didn't surface until the next day.
And the videotape he's referring to was the one caught by the supposed French film crew known as the Naudet brothers, who were in New York City filming New York City firefighters and supposedly just by luck caught the plane hitting the first tower. I've done a show on the questionable Naudet brothers, which you can find on radioforall.net if you'd like more information about these apparently fraudulent Naudet brothers. And now let's take a look at the Pentagon. Of course, the official government conspiracy theory is that the Pentagon was hit by a plane that had been hijacked by Middle Eastern terrorists. And the plane and the ensuing fires were what caused all of the damage. First, we'll hear what a CNN reporter saw on September 11th in the morning at the Pentagon.
Outside the Pentagon, CNN's military affairs correspondent Jamie McIntyre. And Jamie, you got very close to where that plane went down.
That's right, Judy. A while ago, I walked right up to next to the building where firefighters were still trying to put out the blaze. The fire, by the way, is still burning in some parts of the Pentagon. And I took a look at the huge gaping hole that's in the side of the Pentagon in an but front. My close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in. And as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around.
There's a lot of disagreement within the 9/11 Truth movement about what did or did not hit the Pentagon. But what has been proven is that there were also bombs going off in the Pentagon on 9/11, just like in the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7. April Gallup, who was working at the Pentagon on 9/11, said she saw no plane parts, no luggage, no passengers, bodies, etc., and nothing to indicate that a passenger plane had hit the Pentagon. Perhaps this next slip-up by 9/11 Commissioner Tim Romer reveals what really happened.
At any point during this day, were you just, in a very base way, afraid?
There were many times, Miles, that you were afraid, that you were worried, especially when I was standing in front of the Pentagon that night, seeing one of our fortresses pried open by a missile airplane.
Okay, let's hear that again.
Fortresses pried open by a missile airplane.
Mr. Romer catches himself quickly there. You know, the actual government name for their investigation into 9/11 is called PENTBOMB, and that's spelled P-E-N-T-T for Twin Towers, bomb. So PENTBOMB. I mean, that name in itself raises a few questions. And now here's Bill Clinton on the Neil deGrasse Tyson show slipping up on the Pentagon. He doesn't seem to even get that he's made a mistake here, and that he's contradicting the official government story about what happened at the Pentagon.
By the time I had been a governor 12 years, when I got elected president, I felt that there were basically three components to any job like that. You had to have a vision for where you wanted to go, lay out a strategy, and try to execute that. That's the one thing. Second, you had to deal with the incoming fire. When George Bush and Al Gore ran for president, they had three debates. Nobody said, what are you going to do when the twin trade towers come down and the Pentagon's bombed.
And let's hear that again.
Twin trade towers come down and the Pentagon's bombed.
But now let's move on to slip-ups about what happened to Flight 93. The official government conspiracy theory is that the plane crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, while the brave passengers were attacking the alleged Middle Eastern hijackers. And now here's former Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld, shedding some light on what may have really happened to Flight 93 that supposedly had crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
If we imagine the kind of world we would face if the people who bombed the Death Ball in Mosul, or the people who did the bombing in Spain, or the people who attacked the United States in New York, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania and attacked the Pentagon.
And let's hear that again.
Or the people who attacked the United States in New York, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania and attacked the Pentagon.
And again, when someone in the 9/11 truth movement talks about Flight 93 being shot down, we're called conspiracy theorists. And now here's what an eyewitness had to say about Flight 93.
I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground. Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet long and probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
And now here's former Vice President Dick Cheney himself making a similar bloop about Flight 93.
You and the president had earlier discussed rules of engagement for taking down a hijacked airplane, but you were the one who gave the direct order to shoot down a plane that you were told, as it turns out incorrectly, was headed for Washington.
Right. That's correct.
What's that moment like?
Well, it was necessary. And it was a... frankly, I didn't pause to think about it very much, because once one of those aircraft was hijacked, it was a weapon. We'd seen already, by that time, three of them go in to the Pentagon and the World Trade Center in New York. As a result, thousands died, and if we had been in a position to intercept one of those to keep it from striking its target, would we have done it? Absolutely. And what I did was pass on the president's approval of the basic proposition that we would, in fact, authorize our people to shoot down aircraft that had been hijacked and refused to divert. So I saw it as part of my responsibility, but I did it quickly because we had a lot of other things we were doing at the same time.
Dick Cheney is clearly talking about Flight 93 here, but he seems to have forgotten that the 9/11 Commission report said that Flight 93 crashed in Shanksville, and the reason you can't see any of it there is that it fell into a mine shaft below and was sucked into that hole. So both Rumsfeld and Cheney contradict the 9/11 Commission report and support what many in the 9/11 truth movement have been saying for years, which was that Flight 93 was shot down over Pennsylvania. And the evidence to support that is that there were parts from the plane found over an 8-mile radius. So these government officials that you just heard can't seem to keep the propaganda separate from what really happened on 9/11. Maybe that's why the corporately controlled, quote, mainstream media outlet, The Washington Post, recently published an article with a list of 200, quote, fake news outlets. Perhaps it was to help these aging government officials with perhaps bad memories keep the story straight by getting their news from the right sources. Some of the supposedly fake news outlets on the list of 200 are InfoWars, that's Alex Jones, Zero Hedge, True Activist, Natural News, Ending the Fed, The Corbett Report, which is one of my favorites, Washington's Blog, another good site, Before It's News, Ron Paul Institute, Hang the Bankers. Now, there's one I hadn't heard of, but now I'll check it out thanks to this Washington Post article. It goes on to add The Activist Post, The Anti-Media, Veterans Today, South Front. And by the way, southfront.org is a good website if you want to follow what's going on in Syria. So I can understand why they don't want you to see that one. And continuing on the list, Your Newswire, America's Freedom Fighters, Global Research, my really favorite website, and Paul Craig Roberts, another great website. Many of the websites that have been labeled, quote, fake news, have challenged the official story of 9/11 and the government and corporate media's demonization of Russia and Putin. It's quite an irony that a once respected corporate and, quote, mainstream media outlet such as the Washington Post would come out with an article with a list of, quote, fake alternative news sites when it was instrumental in promoting the false news of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, to name just one example, that helped to gather public support for the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Journalist Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Documented in one of her books that there were over 400 CIA agents working in the corporate media. So I ask you, who are the real fake news outlets? The list of 200 alternative websites listed in the Washington Post, or the Washington Post itself? I think listening to Udo Ulfkott, German journalist and whistleblower, will help to answer that question. And here he is, Udo Ulfkott. And this is from an interview he did on Russia Today.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years, and I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. But seeing right now, within the last months, how the German and American media tries to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia, this is a point of no return. And I am going to stand up and say it is not right what I have done in the past to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia. And it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became an honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States just because I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors. There are many examples for that. If we go just back to history, if you go into the year 1988, if you go to your archives, you will find in March 1988 that there was in Iraq, the Kurdish people have been gassed with poisoned gas. That is known all over the world. But in July 1988, they sent me to a town called Zubaydat, that is on the Iraqi-Iranian border. It was war between the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I was sent there to photograph how the Iranians have been gassed with poisoned gas, with German poisoned gas. You call it Lost and Zarin, mustard gas, made by Germany. They have been gassed, and I was there to make photographs how these people have been killed by poisoned gas from Germany. When I came back to Germany, there was just one small photo in a newspaper, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and there was one small article, not writing how impressive, brutally, how unhuman, how terrible it was to kill decades after the end of the Second World War people with German poisoned gas. So this was a situation I feel misused for having been there and just to give a documentary what has been done, but not being allowed to cry out to the world what we have done behind closed doors. Up to today, it's not well known in the public that with German public gas, there have been hundreds or thousands of people gassed in this city of Zubaydat. Now, you ask, what have I done for intelligence agencies? So please see, most of the journalists you see in foreign countries, they claim to be journalists, and they might be journalists, European or American journalists, but many of them, like me in the past, are so-called non-official cover. That's what the Americans call that. I have been a non-official cover. Non-official cover means what? It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you are not only a journalist, but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too now. Like I feel ashamed that I have worked for a very recommended newspaper like the Frankfurter Allgemeine because I was bribed by billionaires, I was bribed by the Americans not to report exactly the truth. But I just imagined in my car while I was driving to this interview, I just tried to work out in my brain what would have happened if I would have written a pro-Russian article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. Well, I don't know what would have happened, but we were all educated to write pro-European, pro-American, but please, not pro-Russian. So I'm very sorry for that, but this is not what I understand for democracy and for press freedom. I'm very sorry for that. Germany is still a kind of a colony of the United States. You see that in many points, like the majority of the Germans don't want to have nukes in our country, but we still have American nukes. So we are still a kind of a colony of the Americans. And being a colony, it is very easy to approach young journalists through what is very important here is transatlantic organizations. All journalists from really respected and recommended big German newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, they are all members or guests of those big transatlantic organizations. And in these transatlantic organizations, you are approached to be pro-American. And there is nobody coming to you and say, well, we are the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you like to work for us? No, this is not the case how it happens. What they do, these transatlantic organizations, is they invite you for seeing the United States. They pay for that. They pay all your expenses and everything. So you are bribed. You get more and more corrupt because they make you good contacts. You won't know that those good contacts are, let's say, non-official covers or officially people working for Central Intelligence Agency or other American agencies. So you make friends. You think they are friends and you cooperate with them. They ask you, well, could you do me this favor? Could you do me that favor? And so your brain more and more is brainwashed through these guys. And is this only the case with German journalists? No. I think it is especially the case with British journalists, because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israelis, of course, with French journalists far apart, not that big as with German or with British journalists. It is the case for Australian journalists, for journalists from New Zealand, from Taiwan, from, well, there is many countries in the Arab world, like Jordan, for example, like Oman, the Sultanate of Oman. There is many countries where this happens, where you find people to claim they are respected journalists, but if you look behind them, you'll find they are puppets on a string of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sometimes the intelligence agencies, they come to your office and want you to write an article. I give you an example, not from strange other journalists, from me myself. I've just forgotten the year. I just remember that the German Foreign Intelligence, Bundesnachrichtendienst, it is just a sister organization of the Central Intelligence Agency. It was founded by the American Intelligence Agency. So one day, the BND, this German Foreign Intelligence Agency, came to my office at the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Frankfurt, and they wanted me to write an article about Libya and about Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. I had absolutely no secret informations regarding Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and Libya. But they gave me all these secret informations, and they just wanted me to sign the article with my name. I did that, but it was an article that was published in the Frankfurt Allgemeine that originally came from the Bundesnachrichtendienst, from the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. So do you really think that this is journalism? Intelligence agencies writing articles? That article was how Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, how he secretly tried to build a poison gas factory, I think in Rabta was the name, yeah. It was a story that was printed worldwide 2 days later. But I had no information on that. It was the intelligence agency that wanted me to write this article. So, but this is not the way journalism should work, that intelligence agencies, that they decide what is printed and what not. If I say no, I give you a very good example if you say no. Well, we have a rescue unit in Germany with helicopters for traffic accidents. They call themselves the Yellow Angels. There was one guy who didn't want to cooperate. He was a pilot of the helicopter service of the Yellow Angels in Germany. This guy said no to the Foreign Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, when they approached him and wanted him as a non-official cover to work for the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, just to pretend to be somebody from the Yellow Angels. So what happened was that he lost his job. And the court in Germany, the judge decided that they were right, because such a guy could not be trusted. He was kicked off his job because he didn't cooperate with the Foreign Intelligence Service. So I knew what would happen if I would not cooperate with intelligence services. I have had 6 times my house was house searched because I was accused by the public prosecutor, the German public prosecutor. I was accused of leaking secrets of states. 6 times house searched. Well, they hoped that I wouldn't do that ever again. But I think it's worse that the truth will come out one day. The truth won't die. And I don't mind what will happen. I've had 3 heart attacks. I have no children. So if they want to bring me to court or to prison, so it's worse for the truth.
And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Attorneys for Indigenous activist Lynette Peltier have submitted a formal application for executive clemency to the Office of the Pardon Attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. An innocent man, Native American activist Lynette Peltier, was wrongly convicted in connection with the shooting deaths of two agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in 1977, has been in prison now for over 40 years. We're joined by attorneys Martin Garbus, who has appeared before the United States Supreme Court as well as trial and appellate courts throughout the United States. He has written numerous briefs that have been submitted to the United States Supreme Court, a number of which have resulted in changes in the law on a nationwide basis. Garbus also participated in drafting several constitutions and foreign laws, and he's been involved in prisoner exchange negotiations between governments and has authored six books. Cynthia Dunn, director of a nonprofit corporation that works with youth on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, worked for 28 years as an assistant United States attorney, where she prosecuted a broad variety of cases, including public corruption and civil rights offenses. Martin Garbus and Cynthia Dunn make the case for clemency for Lynette Peltier.
Hi.
Cynthia, I want to begin with you. You wrote for Indian Country Media Network, quote, "When I left my job after 28 years as a federal prosecutor to volunteer on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, I was warned by a friend for the community. Do yourself a favor. Never state an opinion about Lynette Peltier. Well, we both assumed I would oppose Peltier's release from prison. We were wrong." Now, speaking as a legal aid lawyer to a former federal prosecutor, your involvement, your interest, your pursuing clemency for Lynette Peltier. Tell us your story on that.
Thanks for referencing that, because that's a good point. I wrote that piece that you're referencing to in Indian Country Today in 2015, before I was hired by Lynette Peltier, before I met Martin Garbus, before I had any idea I would ever have any contact with either. I, working on the reservation, heard about the 1970s all the time from the elders in the community. It's something that still has, or is a source of pain in the community. They call it the Reign of Terror because of the high crime rate and the seeming apathy from federal law enforcement to bring prosecutions for the major crimes on the reservation. And then this particular incident that occurred in 1975, again, is something that comes up all the time. And the name Lynette Peltier, I had heard it as a prosecutor, but I had basically accepted wholesale the FBI's representation that he was a cold-blooded murderer who willingly and deliberately shot two FBI agents at close range in the head mercilessly. And they've got all sorts of adjectives that go with it. And I'd accepted that. So we both assumed that I was just going to find that if I ever looked into it. But it just kept coming back, and people were so adamant that there was a great injustice there, and working in the community, it was just something that always comes up. So I ultimately decided, well, I'll look into it for myself and see what I can find. And there's a learning curve involved in this case. As a newcomer to considering the case, there is a learning curve to get past what I'm going to call the propaganda about the case. It took me over 100 hours of looking at publicly available records, public press reports, court records, etc. And I formed the opinion that this was a really great injustice here, and it ran contrary to everything that I had believed in for my 28 years working in the justice system. I just felt like, wow, how could our government, when we threw it to today's lens, how can we let this stand? And so I wrote that piece, and then after that, I was contacted by Martin Garbus and really met with Lynette Peltier. And agreed to represent him and work with Mr. Garbus on the case. He's the lead counsel. But the point is that after that, I got access to even additional records, the Freedom of Information Act records that aren't necessarily readily available online, the internal FBI records of the time that show an even stronger case for, I think, perhaps one of the greatest injustices in the history of the justice system. So that's how I came to I'm with the team.
That's a heck of an indictment to Martin Garvis. Pick it up from there. I mean, Peltier has been designated a political prisoner by Amnesty International, and people such as Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu had risen to the occasion of support for him. The case for the injustice that has been perpetrated against Leonard Peltier that has caused you to be his champion.
I was in Nebraska and in South Dakota and in Minneapolis when the Wounded Knee cases were tried. And I represented a number of defendants in Nebraska after the 73 shootout. And I got to understand then Leonard's case. I saw that two other people who were charged with the same crime were ultimately acquitted. I saw the justice system take Leonard's case and move it to a judge was one of the most, a judge who was most hateful to the Indian community, had total disrespect for them. I saw the justice system shuffle itself so that Leonard could get extradited based on false affidavits from Canada so that he would ultimately stand trial. And then ultimately, when it came to the trial itself, the government acknowledged during the trial, after the trial, that they didn't know who shot the two FBI men. And the ballistics evidence did not support the claim. In fact, it contradicted the claim that Leonard had done the shooting. Well, now Leonard is at 72. He's been in jail for 42 years. He has spent a good deal of that time in solitary for a crime he did not commit. One of the most unusual things of this case, and it really sets it apart, I think, from any other American trial, is the federal appellate judge asking that Leonard be released because of the government's misconduct during the trial. It's as heinous a case of government misconduct as you will see. And for that, Leonard Peltier has spent his life in jail. And if he doesn't get out now through Obama, he will most certainly die in jail. It's unlikely that Trump, whether he's there for one or two terms or whoever, is going to release him. If Obama does not, then who will? So we are trying as much as we can. And Cynthia has been running an extraordinary campaign. She's been in Washington. She's met with members of Congress. She's labored endlessly because we all realize that unless it happens by the time Obama leaves, it will not happen. It's very funny. In America, the case is known at some level. But if you go outside of America, then you find that it's extraordinarily well known. He's America's leading political prisoner outside of the United States. There should be an article either today or tomorrow in The Guardian, the British newspaper, about this case, as there already have been articles in much of the media, and there also has been, in addition to this show, other television and radio stations that have been dealing with the case. So it's an enormous issue. If in fact, there's any commitment on the part of Obama to reach out to the Native American community, this is that case. At Standing Rock, the demonstrators had placards demanding the release of Leonard Peltier, and they were singing and protesting. So it's an issue from 1975, which is, you know, some 40 years, and the issue stays alive, and this wrongfully convicted man, at this point, stays in jail.
And Cynthia, I want to go back to what you said, which is really dramatic and remarkable for someone who was a federal prosecutor, and we're talking about the death of two FBI agents, and you're saying this is the most egregious case of misconduct and misjustice that you have ever experienced.
Okay, I mean, well, it's really, at this point, part of history. Some of the most egregious injustices are really not subject to credible dispute. They've been found so by the courts. The courts have commentated on it. And as Mr. Garvis just mentioned, the appellate judge who reluctantly held the verdict in place, nonetheless said, we need to do something about this, and he should be granted clemency. The injustices include, among other things, there were multiple false statements to the press in order to gain a tactical advantage. There were false affidavits submitted to the courts that were just patently false. When you put them next to each other, you can see that they were just created to try to get a result-oriented decision from a court rather than justice. They coerced witness statements, and I guess most telling to me is that they deliberately withheld critical ballistic reports from Mr. Peltier's attorneys during the trial. Among my first look, when I was looking through records on my own, I came across a couple of interviews with the prosecutors from the case, and they said, oh, well, you know, this is such a big case, and there are so many people prosecuting the case, and we lost those records. It wasn't a deliberate withholding of the ballistics reports. That might sound credible in a case like Bernie Madoff investigation, where you've got lots of paper. But I've done murder cases. I've prosecuted murder cases. You don't have a whole lot of paper. And the only person you really look for paper on is going to be your ballistics expert, because that's what they're there for, is to testify about their test results. But somehow they lost his test results, and so had him testify contrary to his own test results. But among the records that we have attached to the petition is a FBI memorandum, a teletype, which is how they communicated before the internet, from an FBI agent to his supervisors, reporting during trial that the prosecutors had deliberately directed them not to produce ballistics reports to Mr. Peltier's attorneys at trial. So some lying FBI agent out there thought this was such an extraordinary direction that they memorialized it in writing. What that shows me is there was a real deliberate decision at the time by prosecutors, and was gone along with by the FBI agents, to give Mr. Peltier a patently unfair trial and to ensure that he was convicted. The prior trial that Mr. Barbas referred to of his co-defendants, Butler and Robidoux, they had debriefed the jurors, and the jurors had told them, among other things, that they would never convict someone in these facts because the place was such a politically charged war zone and the two agents entered private property unannounced. They would never convict someone of killing them unless the government could prove that someone was a cold-blooded murderer who had shot these guys deliberately in the head. And so that's what they went out to prove in the trial. And that's why they withheld evidence and they changed the theory of the case when it came to Mr. Peltier's trial. They went out to try to hold someone accountable. And Leonard Peltier has been done 40 years in jail and a staggering 5 or 6 years of that time in solitary confinement, which makes it exponentially a much stiffer sentence. And it's really one of the greatest injustices that you'll see when you look at cases. It's just, it's mind-boggling to me. Now, we do know that the FBI is actively opposing his release this time around. We received a letter that they oppose his release because the crimes, quote, challenge the rule of law our criminal justice is built on. You know, while the rule of law ordinarily is something that is praiseworthy, in this case, it's a shield. It prevents self-reflection. Where was the rule of law when the prosecutors, agents, and their superiors decided to withhold critical exculpatory ballistics proof? Where was the rule of law when they coerced witnesses to provide false testimony? Mm. You know, you can't use the rule of law to keep them in jail and not look at your own conduct in that analysis. Here, we're 41 years later. I mean, the time was long ago, but if not now, as Martin says, he will surely die in jail. He's next eligible for parole in 2024. He's in very poor health. He's in a maximum security prison. You know, the maximum security prisons are not a young man's game. They are a dangerous place for anybody. And the clemency petition asks that the president release him in the interest of justice and reconciliation. You know, as I stated before, he is emblematic throughout Indian country of this history of injustices. There are very few things that a sitting president can do that is an act, not just talk, about reconciliation, and this is one of them. The NCAI and former UN Rapporteur on Indigenous Rights, they all wrote supporting letters saying this would resound throughout Indian country. This would help restore faith in the law enforcement system, in the communities around the country. It's a big case. It lives on because it has never been faced. It has never been reckoned with, really.
Martin Garbus, I remember when the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals acknowledged back in the early 2000s that much of the government's behavior at the Pine Ridge Reservation and its prosecution of Leonard Peltier was to be condemned. Why hasn't that kind of statement taken us further? Leonard has long been due a new trial and is long overdue for a parole. His application for clemency was denied. His last one in 2009. Place Leonard's case in the context of the incredible bad behavior, the bias, the backwardness of the government's response to the indigenous people in Pine Ridge.
I lived in Pine Ridge for 4 months back then. One of the things that we have really forgotten is the demonstrations. When they occur, Richard Nixon, through General Haig, orders the military to attack the demonstrators. At that point in time, it was astonishing that military personnel, called a posse comitatus, was organized to attack American citizens. It was the first time that had happened in that century. Your question is, why has this not been dealt with? It's not been dealt with in large part because Native Americans are not seen as having political power, are not a respected community. Cynthia has been spending an extraordinary amount of time to get congresspeople to petition to ask President Obama to release Leonard Peltier. She spent some time in Washington last week. Altogether, 55 members of Congress over a period of time have asked that Leonard Peltier be released. But he hasn't been. That's the course of American justice. I represented recently Gerardo Hernandez, a Cuban who had two life sentences plus 15 years. It took a negotiation between another head of state and Obama to get him released. Leonard Peltier doesn't have that kind of clout. He doesn't have large, powerful people speaking on his behalf relentlessly. Yes, he has members of the Congress. He has the liberal community. He has, as Cynthia mentioned, Nelson Mandela, Bishop Tutu, and hosts of others, Ramsey. But, you know, we've seen at Standing Rock, where that community did have some power and was able to achieve some results, certainly with the help of President Obama. Whether or not there's enough power now to persuade the president to release Leonard Peltier is something that we'll see in the years ahead. But Cynthia has, it's unusual for a former prosecutor who prosecuted cases for 28 years, come in and say, as Cynthia has done, this is my professional life. This is who I prosecuted. And here's a case that is so startling that I, for the first time in my professional life, are coming out and condemning government action. So the fact that Cynthia is doing it is a very new and powerful voice on his behalf. And maybe her voice and the effort she has made will result in Leonard being released.
Cynthia Dunn, you made the case before members of Congress. Make the case for us now and tell our listeners what to do to immediately support clemency for Leonard Peltier.
So first and foremost, they should write to their elected officials and ask them to notify the president and the U.S. pardon attorney that they support clemency for Leonard Peltier, that enough is enough. After 41 years, you know, justice has been served under any interpretation of the case, and it's time to allow him to go home for his final years of life and to live his final years of life at Turtle Mountain Reservation. So they can write to their elected officials. They can do it by email or on their websites. The most impactful at this point, probably because we're so short, we've got such a short fuse here, because January 20th is the last day. If he's not the clemency petition is not authorized by then he will likely die in jail. they could write to the president easily through Amnesty International's website. They have it as an action page, and when you click on it, you have the option to sign their petition, which I would urge everybody to do. It takes about 2 minutes, and or you can send a letter to your elected official. It's all completely set up for you. If you want to amend the letter slightly, you can, but you can use that as a tool. It's very easy. It's Amnesty International. This is probably the most impactful way at this time that people can take action. You know, this would be a great injustice. I mean, right now, Leonard Peltier is an icon throughout Indian country and really around the world. When the UN did its report on indigenous people in 2012, they included this as one of the open wounds that is hurting Indian country today. Let's see if we can, you know, get this over the finish line. Right now, it's at the Pardon Attorney's Office, we believe. It has to be handed over to the president before he can act on it. He can't act on it until it gets presented. So let's let everybody get going. It takes 2 minutes. Support what's right. We all should, this shouldn't be politicized. You know, as Martin said, the liberal community supports it. Everybody should be supporting this. If you believe that the justice system stands for equality and equal rights for everyone, and that the protections that we have apply to people who are innocent or guilty, if you believe in those things, then you should support allowing Leonard Peltier to live his final years in the interest of reconciliation and in the interest of justice.
No, I also want to say that people can call the White House. The number is 202-456-1111. That number, again, is 202-456-1111. And you can ask Barack Obama to grant Leonard Peltier clemency. All these calls are logged in, and they are available to the president. So you can go to the Amnesty International website, sign the petition. I know that there are over 55,000 people that have done so to date.
It's over 101,000, actually, this week.
Oh, better. Fabulous. Yeah. So let's get that up to several hundred thousand, which I know with our listeners' support, we can do. I really want to thank both of you. Martin Garvis, the last plea here for our listeners as to why they should get on board for clemency for Leonard Peltier.
There has to be ultimately some sense of decency in the American legal system. We have to go back to the ideas of law and justice. We have to reaffirm what the country is about and what we believe is proper. And the jailing of Leonard Peltier for over 40 years, 6 years in solitary, at amongst other places, Lompoc Prison, one of the most horrendous places in the United States, is awful, and this is the time to deal with it.
I'm going to go back and give another last word to Cynthia Dunn. I'm just interested, as somebody who's spending a great deal of time on the Pine Ridge Reservation, the additional passion of the people there that is behind the clemency. Just tell us about that and how important to Indigenous people's rights, sovereignty, self-determination is freedom for Leonard Peltier.
I'm an outsider in the community. I can report what I've been told, but I can't necessarily speak for them. But I have spoken with several survivors of that era. And one, when she learned that I was involved in the representation of Leonard Peltier, just burst out in tears and said she'd never thought that she would see someone she knows actually standing up for this. And she had lived through the 70s. It hurts, and the pain is still there. And I can tell you that the feeling of that Native Americans are not being treated as equal value in today's society is still there. It's there on the Pine Ridge Reservation. It's there in the border towns. I spend a lot of time in Rapid City. I've actually counseled some entities and civic groups on how to try to help address some of the really blatant discrimination that still exists in the region. It would go a long way for so many different reasons, not only to restore faith in the justice system, but to show that we as Americans are prepared to turn a page and we're willing to look back and we're willing to listen to all of those watchdogs and humanitarians that have stood by him for 40 years, because it's right. It's the right thing to do. So, yeah, I urge everybody to call the White House, get on Amnesty's website, www.amnestyusa.org. It's right there on the front page. You click it, in 2 minutes, you've got a petition signed, and you've got a letter to the president. You'll be doing something good today that will be on the right side, and you'll be standing on the right side of history, because I really do believe this will be recorded by historians as one of the greatest injustices in the history of the American justice system.
And interestingly enough, Judge Gerald Heaney of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, who sat as a member of the court in two of Peltier's appeals, actually talks about Leonard Peltier as a political prisoner and supports the movement for clemency for this man who has on six occasions been nominated for a Nobel Prize. I also must mention that Peltier is an accomplished author and I think one of the finest graphic artists of my lifetime. Just a magnificent, heroic individual who has suffered mercilessly. Courts have, in my understanding and research, had federal prosecutors who have admitted that the government can't prove who shot the agents. The FBI used improper tactics in securing Peltier's extradition initially from Canada and otherwise investigating the case. There is a body of information. We will continue to pursue this right up to the deadline, the case for clemency for Leonard Peltier. Get on board, sign that Amnesty International petition, or call the White House, write to your elected official. Special thanks for the work that they are doing for Leonard Peltier of the two exceptional, socially conscious attorneys, Martin Garvis.
You know, we want to thank you, Cynthia and I, for the program.
Absolutely.
And the things you've said, and giving us a chance to reach people who have been told what they can do. It's very rare that people really within this country can do something by themselves that will have a political and human effect. This is one of those rare cases. Your votes can get lost in elections. There can be confusion. But here you have an opportunity to help save a man's life and make a statement for one of the most important causes and on behalf of one of the most beleaguered minorities in the country. So thank you, Mimi, for what you've done.
Well, thank you all. We are in this together in the cause for justice and the cause for clemency for Leonard Peltier. We've been speaking with Martin Garvis and Cynthia Dunn. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We are the only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
On its way, the march stopped outside Prime Minister Thatcher's residence in Downing Street.
I grew up black. I've been discriminated against all my life. For somebody to discriminate against me because I'm gay is a joke.
People assume that as a feminist, I'm going to do a lot of anti-male humor. I don't really know him that well to make jokes about him.
When people see people who are fearless coming, they get out of the way.
I went back to having mutual oral sex with this man. And then all of a sudden I looked up again and there was this officer standing in my bedroom door.
Where will you be when they come?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Chad outlaws same-gender sex. Cherokee Nation marriage inequality is declared unconstitutional. And flashbacks from 1988 bring the news up to date. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending December 17th, 2016. Chad has become the 77th country in the world to make private consensual adult same-gender sex a crime. Those provisions, part of a new criminal code impacting the Central African country's 13 million people, passed overwhelmingly in Parliament this week. President Idriss Deby is expected to formally approve the new laws. The country's current criminal code is a remnant of its time as a French colony. Chad gained its independence in 1960 and included no specific sanctions against homosexual acts. People found engaging in homosexual relationships will now be guilty of a misdemeanor offense punishable by a fine and suspended jail sentence. That's surely one of the lightest sentences for such a crime among the 77 countries that now outlaw same-gender lovemaking. Justice Minister Hamid Dahalab noted, in fact, that earlier proposals had included prison sentences of up to 20 years.
Previous reports of the political death of Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh may have been premature. One of the world's most notorious homophobes has pushed genocidal anti-gay legislation and once threatened to slit the throats of all LGBT people. He's ruled the West African nation as its president with an iron fist since taking power in a 1994 military coup. Jammeh conceded defeat after the Electoral Commission certified on December 1st that his opponent, Adama Barrow, had won the presidential election by more than 4 percentage points. But Jammeh did an about-face on December 9th and declared the vote null and void because of what he called election abnormalities and demanded fresh and transparent elections, which will be officiated by a God-fearing and independent electoral commission. Barrow, a former security guard and property developer, has no government experience, and his thoughts on LGBT rights are not known. But equality activists hope he'll overturn some of Jammeh's most oppressive anti-gay policies. The UN Security Council is calling on Jammeh to relinquish power. In a unanimous statement, the 15 council members told him to respect the choice of the sovereign people of the Gambia.
Israel's Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit announced on December 8th that the country would recognize the civil marriages of gay and lesbian couples legally performed elsewhere for purposes of granting citizenship to the non-Israeli spouse. That option currently only applies to married heterosexual couples. The announcement responds to a petition filed in the High Court of Justice by the Gay Fathers Association challenging a provision referencing a man and wife in relevant Israeli citizenship laws. The announcement also made clear, however, that the change in policy doesn't represent a general recognition in Israel of the civil marriages of same-gender couples. In fact, civil marriages are not an option for heterosexual couples either. Religious authorities, generally either Jewish or Muslim, are the only ones allowed to marry couples in the country. Neither faith tradition in Israel endorses the marriages of lesbian or gay couples.
But Attorney General M. Todd Hembree of the Cherokee Nation declared this week that the U.S. Native American tribe's ban on the civil marriages of same-gender couples is illegal. The 12-page opinion, published online by the local Tahlequah Daily Press newspaper on December 9th, argues that a 2004 Cherokee law that defined marriage as being explicitly between a man and a woman is unconstitutional. The right to marry without the freedom to marry the person of one's choice, Hembree wrote, is no right at all. The sovereign Cherokee Nation is the largest tribal nation in the United States, with more than 317,000 citizens. Its capital is in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The opinion goes into effect immediately. But longtime tribal council member Don Garvin told the Tulsa World newspaper that he expects his colleagues to support traditional marriage and overturn the decision.
Meanwhile, a judge in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, ruled this week that Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards' executive order banning bias against LGBT state government workers was unconstitutional. It prohibited discrimination in government and state contracts based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But District Judge Todd Hernandez said that the governor has no power to expand or create new state law. The decision came in a lawsuit filed by Republican Attorney General Jeff Landry. He said he challenged the governor's order to uphold the checks and balances on executive authority as established in our state constitution. Edwards says he'll appeal the ruling because discrimination is not a Louisiana value and we are best served as a state when employment decisions are based solely on an individual's qualifications and job performance. Louisiana is one of 28 U.S. states with no employment anti-discrimination protections for its LGBT citizens, and contrary to popular misconception, there is no federal law that bans anti-LGBT bias in the workplace. Landry is seen as a potential challenger to Edwards' re-election bid in 2019. His openly gay brother, Nicholas, took to YouTube to denounce his sibling's move against LGBT rights as uncalled for. Although I'm not political, Nicholas said, I am a human being and I just want my rights.
First-term U.S. Congressman Ryan Zinke of Montana, who once implied that sexual orientation is a choice and called Hillary Clinton the Antichrist, continued the parade of straight white men into the incoming administration of Donald Trump this week. He's the president-elect's pick for Secretary of the Interior. The first-term lawmaker earned a zero on LGBT rights from the Human Rights Campaign. He acknowledges that climate change exists, but says he's not convinced that it's caused by burning fossil fuels.
Former presidential candidate Rick Perry was nominated by Trump this week to head the Department of Energy. It's famously the agency he couldn't remember during a Republican presidential candidate's debate as one of the three he'd get rid of as commander-in-chief. Perry has compared same-gender attraction to alcoholism and led a staunchly anti-LGBT administration as governor of Texas.
ExxonMobil executive Rex Tillerson, who was rumored to be getting the nomination late last week, was confirmed by the Trump transition team this week to be the president-elect's pick for Secretary of State. Aside from concerns being expressed about the oil man's ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin, some equality activists have expressed concerns about how Tillerson will address LGBT rights issues abroad, especially compared to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Tillerson's global energy conglomerate was one of the last Fortune 500 companies to protect its LGBT workers from harassment and discrimination. On the other hand, as an Eagle Scout who served as president of the Boy Scouts of America from 2010 to 2012, Tillerson is said to have been instrumental in getting the organization to open its ranks to openly gay scouts in 2014 and then to out adult leaders a year later.
And finally this week, controversy has clouded the kickoff to Melbourne's Midsummer Festival, the major yearly celebration of all things queer in the Australian state of Victoria. There's been an outcry from the community over the continuing sponsorship of the event by the world's largest newspaper publisher, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, since homophobic editorial cartoons started appearing in the Australian and other News Corp holdings. One depicted LGBT activists as high-stepping, rainbow-draped Nazi stormtroopers. Other editorial cartoons have attacked LGBT-inclusive sex education lessons and featured crude anti-queer stereotypes. An online petition convinced organizers to sever ties with News Corp, which meant losing substantial free advertising space for Midsummer in the company's stable of newspapers as part of the sponsorship deal. A Sydney Morning Herald report confirmed the divorce, citing the organizer's statement lamenting the distraction that's affected the 130-plus artist and community groups who make up our Open Access Festival. We are a small team trying to do big things for a large and very diverse community, they said. In a world that feels significantly more difficult for us all, as we head into 2017.
Believe me.
That's News Wrap for the week ending December 17th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm John Dyer V.
You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters.
I'm Harvey Milk. I'm a supervisor in San Francisco, and I'm gay.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
And here comes the National March on Washington for lesbian gay rights.
The day I finally get to look at the man that I love and say, will you please marry me?
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump!
As an African-American, as an openly gay man, and as an American, that frightens me.
Our latest CD special, Trump Trauma and the Dawn of the Donald, is hot off the presses and available now at thiswayout.org. And remember, This Way Out's queer history CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Pulling out the holiday decorations from This Way Out's closet in preparation for the 2016 year-ending party to celebrate our 1500th program, we found a box marked 6-month anniversary highlights that we just had to open. Inside was this sampler from our first 6 months on the air in 1988, a very queer year, it seems.
Earlier this year, Parliament approved Clause 28 in the United Kingdom, which prohibits municipal funding of any group or activity which promotes homosexuality. Over 50,000 demonstrated against Clause 28 in London.
On its way, the march stopped outside Prime Minister Thatcher's residence in Downing Street, where the marchers made their feelings on this new legislation very clear. Bringing a message of solidarity from gay and lesbian brothers and sisters in North America was one of the organizers of the 1987 March on Washington, Robin Tyler.
Are they arresting people? Do I want to arrest all the gays and lesbians in England, guys? You're going to have to arrest millions and millions and millions of people. Yeah! We are everywhere! You cannot take us out!
Perry Watkins entered the Army at age 19 as an openly gay man. During a career that spanned 15 years in the military, Watkins received promotions, security clearances, and excellent job evaluations. He never hid that he was gay. He twice re-enlisted. Each time, the Army knew he was homosexual. Yet in 1981, the Pentagon decided that all known homosexuals had to be barred from military service, no matter how exemplary their record. The Army tried to discharge Sergeant Watkins, but Sergeant Watkins took the Army to court. In a seesaw legal battle that so far has lasted 7 years, he has yet to win the right to re-enlist and earn a military pension.
Being black and growing up, looking at it, discrimination is the same. It doesn't matter how you color it, how you paint it. You know, that's why I laugh a lot when people say, well, how can you deal with this, you know, all you've been going through? I grew up black. I've been discriminated against all my life. For somebody to discriminate against me because I'm gay is a joke.
Kate Clinton is a gutsy lady. She left her job as an English teacher at the age of 30 to become not just a stand-up comedian, but an out-of-the-closet lesbian feminist stand-up comedian.
people assume that as a feminist I'm going to do a lot of anti-male humor. I don't really know him that well to make jokes about him.
Now, I think it's time that we have a new feminist TV network. PTL, praise the lesbians. And we'd have some early morning religious music. Oh, give me that old lesbianism. Give me that old lesbianism.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
In a three-day conference this past February, several hundred black lesbians and gay men convened in Los Angeles to discuss the emerging leadership in the black, gay, and lesbian communities throughout the country. Keynote speaker, California Assemblywoman Maxine Waters, challenged the listeners to rid themselves of fear in the face of racism, homophobia, and discrimination.
You're much stronger when you have no fear. You're much stronger when you understand people respect you more when you don't have fear. And you're much stronger when you rid yourself of fear because your natural actions are such that you move like a person without fear. And when people see people who are fearless coming, they get out of the way.
Lavelle Dorsey. Charlie Drucker.
I can't help but walk through those lines and lines and lines of panels and see people that I don't know. And the next thing I know, I'm crying.
On its third stop in the 1988 national tour of 20 American cities, the NAMES Project quilt, memorializing the tens of thousands of men and women who have fallen victim to the AIDS epidemic, made a stop in Phoenix, Arizona, the weekend of April 16th. Housed in the Phoenix Civic Plaza, the massive quilt, in this case, 61 squares of 32 name panels each, served as a quiet testament to the brothers and sisters, the sons and daughters, the mothers and fathers, and the friends and lovers who have died from AIDS.
These panels come from, you know, shirts and pieces of material or the things that were important to these people. That's what these panels are made out of.
I only wish more people in Phoenix had dared to visit this memorial to a war of apathy, indecision, public indifference, and red tape.
Chicago, city of the big shoulders. Making sense from the cornucopia of Chicago's great restaurant scene was the six-month project of Chicago editors and gastronomes Bill McBride and Jim Lasaki. The project culminated in the production of an astounding collection of recipes from 91 top Chicago eating establishments. The proceeds from the new cookbook benefit Chicago House, a not-for-profit corporation that operates residences for persons with AIDS.
We were walking to restaurants in the hot summertime, and when you walk in on a cook on a Saturday afternoon in a very nice restaurant, you know, and he's back there running his kitchen, and in comes this person through the alley back door, because that's how we learned how you get into kitchens, and that's where we needed to be. And there were a couple of times where not the nicest things were said, you know, kind of the spicy comments.
With hunger pains and an urge to make some dishes dirty, in Chicago, the city of the big hips, I'm Barry Wick.
Three gay University of California, Los Angeles students filed suit against Disneyland for not allowing them to slow dance at the Magic Kingdom on April 11th.
We're fighting for the injunction to show Disneyland as well as other businesses of all kinds that you can't just walk all over somebody's civil rights because they're doing something that you don't particularly agree with.
So we gotta fight back. In large numbers, a fight back. I can't make it alone. Fight back. In large numbers, together, we can make a safe home. Fight back.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You are listening to This Way Out,
the showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
We're meandering down memory lane through some highlights of our first 6 months on the air with some of the volunteer correspondents who've made This Way Out possible since April 1988, like Tim Richardson, Robin McCall, Anthony Price, Christopher McPherson, Barry Wick, Andrew Ross Exler, Rob Atkinson, Alan Ross, and John Zay. You'll hear from more old friends on next week's landmark This Way Out number 1500. But now, let's return to the year it all began.
First time in Canada that a national political figure, or for that matter a person at the provincial level, did say that he happened to be gay, and so I didn't really know what to expect.
Sten Robinson belongs to the New Democratic Party, the party that traditionally occupies the left of center in Canadian politics.
There's been a very important national debate. Even the kinds of very, very homophobic attitudes that have been displayed on the part of some, it's not a bad thing to have them exposed. And at the same time, I've just been enormously encouraged by the phone calls, the letters, the telegrams that I've gotten from literally right across the country, every province, every territory, small communities, big cities. It's really been really quite moving.
Initially, I saw the door, it was like partially cracked, and the door opened a bit. I looked up and nobody was there, and I didn't think anything of it. And I went back to having mutual oral sex with this man for about 45 seconds, and then all of a sudden I looked up again, and there was this officer standing in my bedroom door. And I asked him what he was doing there. It seemed like a pretty reasonable question.
Hardwick filed a civil suit at the Federal District Court to challenge the Georgia sodomy statute so that the kinds of intrusions into his bedrooms would cease. Unfortunately, he lost.
Get the court! Out of our bedrooms! Get the court! Out of our bedrooms!
Hardwick is a decision that relegates gay men and lesbians to the status of criminals in 25 states in the District of Columbia because of who we love.
Oklahoma, crime against nature, 10 years. Rhode Island, crime against nature, 7 years minimum.
We want the Supreme Court out of our bedrooms.
The court.
We want the government and police out of our bedrooms. We want the rights that all Americans want, including the most fundamental and basic of all rights, which is the right to be left alone.
Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court supreme enough. To keep me from my dreams. Ooh. Ain't no court supreme enough.
No, no.
Ain't no court supreme enough. Ain't no court
no
supreme
way.
Enough.
Yeah, yeah.
To keep me from my
want equal rights, so should we have queers as cops?
They're out of their heads. They are. It's wrong. I think it's stupid.
Yeah, if they want to do their thing, let them go someplace else.
They want us to do what they want, and we don't want to do that.
They like for people to be gay. Like.
The way they're dressing, the way they're waving their arms at you.
Why don't you do things the way God made us do it?
God gave
is your mother and father a lesbian?
I know. God does not want two girls and two guys doing what half these people here are doing. They need help. Any person who is gay is sick.
My sweet Sherry, how long will you run? No hiding place. Over there,
where will you be when they come? They will not come a mob rolling through the streets, but quickly and quietly move into our homes to remove the evil, the queerness, the faggotry from their midst. They will not come clothed in brown and swastikas or bearing chests heavy with gleaming crosses. The time and need for such ruses are over. They will come in business suits to buy your homes and bring bodies to fill your jobs. They will come in robes to rehabilitate and white coats to subjugate. And where will you be when they come? Where will we all be when they come? And they will come. They will come because we are defined as opposite, perverse, and we are perverse. Every time we watched a queer hassled in the streets and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we lied about the boyfriend or girlfriend at coffee break, it was an act of perversion. Every time we heard, I don't mind gays, but why must they be blatant, and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let a lesbian mother lose her child and did not fill the courtrooms, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straights make out in our bars while we couldn't touch because of the laws, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straight relatives bury our dead and push our lovers away, it was an act of perversion. And they will come for the perverts. And it won't matter if you're homosexual, not a faggot, lesbian, not a dyke, gay, not queer. It won't matter if you own your own business, have a good job, or an SSI. It won't matter if you're black, Chicano, Native American, Asian, or white. It won't matter if you're from New York or Los Angeles, Galveston, or Sioux Falls. It won't matter if you're butch or femme, not into roles, monogamous, non-monogamous. It won't matter if you're Catholic, Baptist, atheist, Jewish, or MCC. They will come. They will come to the cities and to the land, to your front rooms and in your closets. They will come for the perverts. And where will you be when they come?
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump!
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Sarah Sweeney and John Dyer V contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Teresa Troll, Bob Marley, Reflex, Holly Near, Diana Ross, The Bobby Fuller Four, Janice Lieber, and Chop Liver Productions, and Mary Watkins performed some of the music you heard, along with poetry from the 1979 March on Washington by Pat Parker. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This way out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you individual listener donors who make this program possible. There are three things you can do to add your support during our countdown to This Way Out number 1500. See what they are and what special gifts are under the tree for you at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon, wishing you and yours all the best during the holiday season. And thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WTND Macomb, Illinois, 2MIA Griffith, New South Wales, KOPN Columbia, Missouri, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since Donald Trump was elected president, many on the left have wondered out loud whether Bernie Sanders would have won more decisively against him than Hillary Clinton. Others have uttered their relief that it wasn't Sanders who lost to Trump, as the left would have been blamed for Trump's presidency for a generation. Jeffrey Sinclair, co-editor of Counterpunch, followed every twist and turn of the Sanders campaign. His postmortem, Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution, looks at Sanders, the base of his supporters, and whether the Democratic Party can be the staging ground for a renewed left. Given the battles to come with Trump, these questions seem especially pertinent. Jeffrey, looking in hindsight, do you think it was a lost cause to run on the leftward side of the Democratic Party as Sanders did?
I don't think it was a lost cause. I don't think Sanders had any chance of winning the nomination. And I assume that he knew that when he entered the primaries. So the question then becomes, you know, what was his objective? And did he succeed? If the objective was to catalyze a movement around a political campaign, which I think is a perfectly rational objective, then I think that he succeeded probably beyond his, you know, wildest dreams. I do think that something maybe happened, you know, in the beginning of the campaign, which was maybe Sanders becoming somewhat intoxicated on his own poll numbers, and, you know, maybe became entranced with the idea that he just might win this thing. And I think that he, if that happened to him, I don't know. But that certainly did that sense of a kind of euphoria of possibility, I think, did infect his movement, which I dubbed the Sandinistas. And I think, in a way, that kind of delusion undercut his that organizing a little bit. Maybe that remains to be seen.
To what degree do you think he was committed to trying to create a broader movement before the intoxication set in?
I don't think he created a movement. I think that he catalyzed it, or movements that had been percolating, and more than percolating in many cases, gravitated toward him. So he became a kind of center of gravity for a lot of political movements that had been at work in Obama time that maybe a lot of people hadn't paid any attention to because, you know, I mean, what's to protest, you know, with Obama, right? He's great. Huh? And so you had the minimum wage movement was one, and obviously the remains of the Occupy movement. Those were there, and I think that they became a rallying force for Sanders. What he wasn't able to do, tragically, I think, was to really form a relationship with the Black Lives Matter movement. In fact, he stumbled out of the gate. I think we'll all remember that moment when he was confronted by Black Lives Matter protesters early on in the campaign and just stood there mute, really had no response to their critique. I don't know if that was fatal or not, but it certainly hobbled his ability to expand the movement outside of the sort of nexus of white college students.
Well, I'd like to talk more as we go on about his supporters, but before we get to that, what was he up against in going up against Clinton? And I mean, in a broad sense, since, as you're saying, the ultimate goal wasn't necessarily to become the candidate for the Democratic Party.
Well, he was up against an institution, really the house that the Clintons built, which is a party of neoliberals with deep ties to Wall Street, with deep ties to defense contractors and the corporate world. It was, you know, the origins of this go all the way back to really the mid-'80s with the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, which Al Gore and Joseph Lieberman and Bill Clinton were founding members of. And basically, they wanted to take the party away from the McGovern wing, right? Not that the McGovern wing ever really controlled the Democratic Party, but they wanted to stamp out that old liberalism of the Great Society and even the New Deal and replace it with something that was more corporate friendly. And they succeeded, certainly with the election of Bill Clinton, and they wiped out really the old infrastructure of the DNC and replaced it with their people. And it became essentially a money-raising operation, shaking down, you know, Goldman Sachs and Citibank and Lockheed, all the big corporations, and sort of purging a lot of the union activists, a lot of the environmental activists, the social justice and economic justice activists who'd been inside the leadership of the Democratic Party. And it has continued that way for, you know, 25 years. I think one of Obama's greatest failings, to the extent that he is somewhat less of a neoliberal than the Clinton, is that he did not reshape the DNC in his own image. He kind of left the Clinton people in charge of it. And so by the time Hillary's running again in 2016, she has complete control over the apparatus of the party.
How much of the support that Sanders got do you think was for him, and how much do you think was, in essence, a reaction to Clinton? You know, that this was the alternative to the neoliberalism of Clinton, what she represented, her hawkishness, and so on.
I don't know if you could break it down in percentage, but I would say that a great deal of it was a reaction against Clinton. many of the Obama people really still had bitter feelings over the way the Clintons had run the race baiting campaign against Obama in 2008. I think that the anti-interventionist left really viewed Clinton as and her whole operation from Samantha Power and Victoria Nuland as dragging Obama into certainly the Libyan conflict and having, you know, a very hawkish attitude toward Syria, Iran, very provocative toward Russia, and sort of central to, you know, what became known as the Asian pivot, and a much more belligerent attitude toward China. Now, Sanders, I think one of his failings was that he did not talk very much about foreign policy in the campaign, and didn't completely capitalize on that growing resentment on the progressive wing of the party and independents as well, and Greens on Hillary's really ultra hawkish and belligerent foreign policy.
Right. Well, the question of that I asked you before about to what degree were people supporting Sanders and to what degree were they opposing Clinton by supporting Sanders is relevant here too, because I think for a lot of people, the assumption that they made in terms of supporting Sanders was that he was not the hawk that Clinton was. And as you say, she was especially hawkish. But his history, his track record has not been fantastic on that question.
No, he was effectively neutralized by his own record. You know, you go back to when Sanders was first in the Congress. He, you know, the at that time, you know, calling himself an independent socialist from Vermont, you know, one of his first major votes was to endorse the bombing of an independent socialist country, Yugoslavia. And this so outraged many of his staffers that several of his top staffers resigned. A few people, I go over this in the book, a few people remember that Sanders, even though he attacked Hillary for voting for the Iraq War during Bush time, just a few years earlier, in fact, it would have been, 3 years earlier, I think, he voted three times to endorse the really genocidal sanction regime that the Clinton administration had imposed on Iraq, which killed more than 500,000 Iraqi kids, voted three times to endorse that, and voted twice for regime change in Iraq under Clinton. Now, his policy changed, you know, his position changed under Bush, but, you know, he had voted for regime change at least twice in Iraq. His policy on Libya was also one of regime change. So he couldn't effectively counter Hillary's foreign policy. And, you know, he could have said, you know, well, I made a mistake on these, and, you know, the evidence is clear that this kind of reckless interventionism has blown up in our face, but he chose not to.
What about Israel? Tell us about his track record there.
Well, I think he's been as devoted as almost every other Democrat to the state of Israel. And, you know, that's really the price of the ticket that all Democrats seem to pay. I mean, there have been a few who've gone astray, like Cynthia McKinney, but they've paid the ultimate price. So there was really no breathing space between Hillary and Sanders on Israel and the Palestinians.
Jeffrey Sinclair is my guest. He is co-editor of Counterpunch and author of Bernie and the Sandernistas, The Programs Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. One of the themes of, if we can call it that, of the election season that has now come to an end was that in Trump and in Bernie Sanders, there was something in common in some way that they were twins. Now, that course, is often a very easy trope, the media especially saying the left and the right resemble each other. But to what degree do you feel like Trump and Sanders drew on some of the same impulses in terms of their support?
Well, I think that that Trump certainly began to mime many of Bernie's themes. I don't think Trump was particularly anti-free trade, but he saw the appeal that Sanders was making to white working class, blue-collar voters on the trade issue. And there's no doubt that that has been fermenting, you know, deeply in the Republican Party since at least the, you know, Buchanan campaign. And Trump was really the first Republican candidate I can think of, other than Buchanan, and maybe to some extent Mike Huckabee in populist mode, was actually talking to those, I guess we would call them the Reagan Democrats. I think they're fully Republicanized now and weaponized as such. But Trump was really the first one to talk to them on economic issues rather than on these, you know, social issues that the Republicans have thrown to them over the decades. And in that sense, you know, I think that they were sort of speaking in similar language to similar demographics. But I don't think Trump meant any of it, as you can tell from, you know, the billionaires that he's stocking his cabinet with.
Indeed.
And it's multi-billionaires. I mean, the poor guy who's just been nominated to be Secretary of the Army, you know, it's worth $1.8 billion, which used to mean something, but now it only gets you the sort of sub-cabinet post as Secretary of the Army. You have to be a multi-billionaire, you know, to get a plum position, I guess.
Right, like Secretary of State. So one of the things that one can see, though, as a parallel, and on top of what you're just mentioning in terms of appealing to these social issues, another thing that Trump and Sanders both seem to draw from in different ways is on the past. Politicians obviously often do this, but, you know, and the power of nostalgia is very strong. Trump's shtick was make America great again, because obviously it used to be and isn't now. And in a way, actually, Sanders, without using that same language, also offered a return to the past.
I agree with that. In fact, you know, I sort of closed the book with the sort of reverie of Sanders. And he's appealing to a different past, right? He's appealing to a past when America thought of itself as good, as empathetic, as caring. The past represented by the New Deal, by the Great Society. And I think that's a comforting notion, but it's also limiting, because it's not speaking toward the future. And I think maybe one of Sanders's greatest failings as a politician was that he was gifted at delivering his own message, almost in a kind of professorial way. But I don't think that he was listening very much to this incredible, energetic movement of largely young people. I mean, he spoke to some of their concerns, such as student loans, but still, I think that his core program, the template for his talks, remained encased in a kind of amber, you know, looking back toward maybe the 40s, the Democratic Party in the 40s.
You mentioned earlier that Sanders missed an opportunity, owing to his own track record, to go after Clinton from the left around foreign policy and bellicosity and so on. And what was interesting was that Trump seemed to, in the same way that perhaps you were mentioning that Trump seemed to be watching how Sanders was appealing to people based on these economic questions, in some ways it seemed like Trump pulled on some of the kind of anti-war rhetoric that we associate with the left, that the left candidate really didn't rise to the challenge to do. And of course, in terms of the practice, what we'll see clearly with Trump is going to be another thing altogether, but there was this harnessing of that anti-interventionist critique that has long been the domain of the left.
It has. And, you know, Trump was very explicit. I mean, his, in ways, I think no Democratic candidate, certainly in my memory, has been in a frontal attack on NATO. We just haven't heard that from very many Democrats. Even I don't even know that, you know, somebody like Dennis Kucinich went that far. And again, hammering over and over on the catastrophe of the Iraq war in much more explicit terms than Sanders did. And really, the Democrats could only respond by, you know, dredging up, you know, some quotes that he made seeming to endorse the war on a Howard Stern show, right? But since that time, he had absolutely, you know, repudiated those quotes and denounced the war in really unambiguous terms, something that certainly Clinton never did. You know, she lives in the sort of in the shadows of ambiguity, right? Nothing ever very explicit out of her mouth. And certainly that was appealing to anti-interventionists. I don't know that it captured many of Sanders' voters. You know, I don't know how deeply you can sort of drill down into the demographics of this election now that so much trash about, you know, Russian hacking and misogyny and all these other excuses have been put forward by the Clinton people. But it certainly there is an anti-interventionist libertarian movement in the country that I think Trump did tap into that maybe undercut the appeal that Gary Johnson and the libertarians might have had otherwise in this election. And I think that Johnson's, you'd have to say, a really poor showing given the opportunities for the libertarians maybe resulted from that these anti-war libertarians ended up voting for Trump because of, you know, he had really hit hard on those issues.
One of Trump's strengths you point to kind of illustrate a deficiency on Bernie Sanders' part, and that was around his charisma. Now, of course, the mainstream media sees Trump as just a buffoon and can't sort of strip away the layers of his appeal. But you write in a great phrase in your book that Trump emits pheromones of doom. Can you tell us what you mean by that and how it contrasts to the lack of pheromones of any kind, I guess, emanating from Sanders or Clinton?
Yeah, I think that he just does. There's something about Trump, and he doesn't speak in complete sentences. He's unlike any public speaker or political figure, I think, that we've ever seen, certainly in my lifetime. But I went to see him down in when he appeared in Eugene. This was early on in the campaign. And, you know, Eugene is, you know, maybe even beyond the socialist republic, you know, as they used to refer to Ann Arbor. And Trump went right in to this, you know, maybe the most self-consciously, you know, progressive city, certainly in the Northwest, if not the country. And he was just electrifying. And he seemed to both feed on and feed at the same time this sense of doom and anger and despair that maybe was even subconscious in some of his audience, and just sort of bring it to the surface. And the event was just electrifying. You can see why, you know, fights were breaking out at a Trump event. It was like a World Wrestling Federation, you know, match. It was wild. But, you know, driving back up to Portland, when I was, you know, trying to remember what it was exactly that Trump had said, I couldn't remember one quote. But, you know, there was, you know, there was just this something that was emanating from his presence that was, you know, certainly thrilled the crowd. And it was undetected by the media, as you said. I mean, they, if anything, the main, you know, his trampling of all the expectations of the mainstream media, you know, certainly for a lot of us, you know, provide a little bit of schadenfreude. because the entire elite establishment was just steamrolled by it. Now, we're definitely going to pay the price for that. But
right, but in some ways continue to be in the sense that it seems like much of the mainstream media can't drill down into what is the sort of driving forces within this person. A lot of the analysis that you get is purely psychological. And while his appointments may be pointing the way to where he's going, you know, a simply psychological analysis of any political figure is just not going to be enough.
No, it's not going to be enough. And so far, the kind of resistance that the Democrats have offered has been really, it's just pathetic. I must say I'm completely mystified by even many of the progressives, such as Michael Moore, the time that they devoted to this, the Hamilton electors, is that what, you know, they were calling them, this, you know,
electoral college
challenge?
Yeah.
Seems completely wasted to me. If I were them, and I'm glad I'm not, but if I were them, what I would have used this opportunity to clean house at the DNC and to completely wage an internal war against the leadership of the Democratic Party. And instead, what you've got is a rationalization of defeat, and you have promoted the same leaders back into the same position. You know, Nancy Pelosi, Charles Schumer. Now, you know, here is a question to ask Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has joined the leadership team of the Democrats in the Senate, where his boss is Charles Schumer, the senator from Citibank. I find that just really hard to process. And it seems to me it's a really wasted opportunity to take this period in the interregnum and not radically reshape the Democratic Party, and instead focus on this fool's errand of somehow stopping Trump in the Electoral College, which is an institution that many of the people leading this campaign believe correctly is undemocratic and racist in its roots.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sinclair, the co-editor of Counterpunch, about his book, Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution, that's published by Counterpunch, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org, and my name is Sasha Lilly. So the Democratic Party, in the wake of Trump's victory in the Electoral College, have been pointing to all sorts of things, as you've indicated, Russian hacking, various reasons not to sort of look within and look at Clinton's failure to garner wider support. Instead, of course, the focus was on these different external factors that sabotage things. One of the interesting things, of course, is there's been a lot of attention to the idea of whether it's a hack or they were leaks, these emails that were embarrassing to Clinton that came out before the election. And, of course, one of them, or a series of them, had to do with the bias that was proved by these emails of the Democratic National Committee against Sanders, which never seems to be mentioned now and hardly was then. You know, the scandal at the time wasn't that there was clear stated bias against Bernie Sanders, but that there was outside interference in American politics.
Right. And I think that Bernie really kind of dropped the ball on this himself, because he could have he had them over a barrel, I think. He wasn't going to win, but he had explicit evidence that they had conspired to rig the primaries against him And he should have used that to force a complete overhaul of the DNC and the party. And instead, what we get, and this just seems completely outrageous to me, one of the co-conspirators, Donna Brazile, replaces the chief conspirator, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to become the new leader of the DNC. And
Donna Brazile, of course, was working for CNN and was exposed for giving questions in advance to the Clinton campaign.
Leaking questions to the Clinton campaign. Just absolutely outrageous, you know, A, as a, quote, journalist, and B, as a member of the party, you know, helping to rig, you know, your own election. And she's been particularly shameless in the aftermath of the election. She's one of the leading voices blaming all of this on Russian hacking and interference. But one thing that we know is that whatever the provenance of the leaks or the hacks of the DNC emails, they're not fake news. This is what the leadership of the party really thought. And they seem to believe, I don't think it's true necessarily, but they seem to believe that that information doomed their election. So what are the Democrats going to do? Are they going to change their leaders? No. Are they going to change what their leaders think? I don't think so. Are they going to learn to lie better? Are they going to get better cybersecurity? I think it's probably, you know, option D there.
Well, but is it realistic to expect that coming out of this, Clinton's defeat, even though she did win the popular vote, is it really reasonable to expect that the Democratic Party is going to look within and change itself? You write in Bernie and the Sandinistas that there have been other, quote, left insurgencies in the past, challenges from the left, Jesse Jackson, Dennis Kucinich, that didn't move the Democratic Party to the left at all in their wake. So is it reasonable to expect that that might happen, or is there something so institutionally fixed about the Democratic Party and its relationship to its leftward side, taking it for granted because ultimately it can, that there is no reason to expect that the Democratic Party is capable of moving to the left?
I don't think that there is going to, that it is capable, because it's been, it is a neoliberal party, certainly from, you know, I don't know from top to bottom, but certainly at the top, and, you know, spread through most of its elected figures, it's a neoliberal party. And they're not going to abandon their neoliberal positions. They're going to have to be forced out. I think that Sanders had the I wish that what he would have done was to go in with the attitude of burning down the house, you know, that it's just beyond salvation. It has to be burned down and it has to be completely rebuilt. To me, that was the only justification of an independent, a lifelong independent, running as a Democrat. And I think of Michelle Alexander. She wrote a very perceptive, the author of
The New Jim Crow.
She wrote a very perceptive piece, I think it was for the New York Review of Books, early on in the Sanders campaign, saying, look, the reason I can't support him is that he's running as a Democrat. And if you're choosing to run as a Democrat, you're almost by definition not a revolutionary. So this image that you're forging a revolution is an illusion to begin with. And, you know, we're at that point where maybe what we really need is a kind of political revolution for the left, and that maybe that revolution is the first step is just giving up on this party and forming something new.
But critics of that position would argue that Sanders would never have gained the prominence that he did had he not run within the Democratic Party. And was there a value to that? Was there a value to him galvanizing the support of especially younger people in seeing some kind of alternative to Clinton neoliberalism?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, doesn't it? It certainly, you know, there's been no evident political benefit out of it. I mean, as I write in the book, you know, he got these pledges in the platform, which were like written in disappearing ink. Yeah, they go into the platform, and then, you know, the ink, you know, disappears, and the platform's put in a vault somewhere, and you never see it again. And in fact, all of these concessions that he supposedly got from Hillary, none of them resurfaced in her campaign. Economic inequality and economic justice weren't a part of her campaign. After Sanders, you know, made his détente with Hillary, even climate change as an issue disappeared from her prepared speeches. So this incredible movement that he built didn't show up, wasn't recognized by Hillary. And now, is it going to have an afterlife during Trump? You know, one can hope so, but if you have the same leadership of the Democratic Party in control, I don't see that it goes very far within the structure. Chuck Schumer is not going to lead any kind of raid on Wall Street. It's not going to happen. And neither is, you know, Nancy, you know, $48 million net worth Pelosi going to lead any kind of restructuring of the party that cuts her off from, you know, this corporate money that they've been dependent on for the past 25 years.
Well, you write extensively about the Democratic National Convention that took place in late July in the appropriately named Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. What do you think Sanders should have done then? I mean, you're saying that you feel like he should have burned the house down on his way out. What didn't happen that could have happened?
Yeah, I don't think he would. By that point, I think he was boxed in. I think he could have stood up for, you know, some of his chief supporters, like, you know, Nina Turner, and, you know, demanded that she be given a speaking role at the convention. I thought that was just horrible on his part. I think his speech could have been, you know, much more a critique of the neoliberal drift of the party than it was. I don't think he had to, you know, essentially wipe out all of the votes of his supporters. I thought that was also a betrayal. But by the time you got to the convention, you know, the die was cast, and he was in a really difficult position that was of his own making. And, you know, that happened, you know, very early on, I think, in the primary campaign, when he made some very poor strategic decisions about how much he was going to attack Hillary frontally. He was very proud, though, of the Sandinistas. I mean, particularly, you know, I'm an Oregonian, and the Oregon, Washington, and I think, you know, some of the California delegation of booing Leon Panetta, you know, the drones are. I thought that was fantastic, of walking out of the convention. I think that kind of energy showed great hope for the movement, because where their leader may have failed them, the energy of the movement survived that failure of leadership. And I think that is a really hopeful sign that something new may come out of this campaign and this failed revolution, as I call it.
Jeffrey Sinclair is my guest. He is the author of Bernie and the Sandinistas, co-editor of Counterpunch. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So turning our attention to the Sandinistas, what do we know of who they are, the basis of their support, to what degree they might be influenced by previous social movements like Occupy? Do we have enough data on who these people are?
I think that it's different regionally, but I do think that the basis of the movement comes out of Occupy and the $15 minimum wage movement. Those really coalesced around Sanders, and then
you have your student movements as well. I mean, Bernie spent, I sort of ridicule him for spending almost all of his time on college campuses. He did, tend to gravitate there. I think that a lot of the energy from the movement was based on campuses. There were opportunities for him to broaden the movement speaking to, 20,000 people in Boise, Idaho, and, 15,000 people, in Austin, Texas. And that's fine. But I thought that, why not take a risk? And when you're in Las Vegas, go to Creech Air Force Base and join the anti-drone movement with a protest there. Why not, when you're in Texas, go to Huntsville and join the anti-death penalty protesters there? Why not show up at picket lines across the country to solidify your relationship? Well, certainly not the union brass, which were locked into the Hillary campaign, but with the rank and file. So I think those were these opportunities for him to sort of break out of this sort of student-based movement were there, and he didn't capitalize on them. Why not join, with Black Lives Matter protesters, on the streets of Cleveland or Baltimore or in Ferguson? Those are the kinds of things that we didn't see from Sanders. And I thought, I'm not that big of a Robert Kennedy fan. It'll be hard for most progressives, if you look too closely at his record, to be one. But when you looked at Kennedy's campaign in 68, you really saw him in urban America, in the poor parts of rural America, in Appalachia. And I think that that was a model that Sanders could have used but didn't, because it was, maybe you're not going to draw 20,000 people there, but you're certainly going to be, I think, broadening the base of your movement. And he failed at that. And I don't think he would have, he would have won, because the odds, and certainly the superdelegates were stacked against him. But if your campaign was about building an enduring national political movement to counter neoliberalism, that's something that he could and perhaps should have done.
Well, thinking about the period we're going into right now, had Clinton been elected, one could imagine that people who had been galvanized by Sanders, the people you dubbed the Sandernistas, that they would have kept up their leftward criticism of Democratic Party neoliberalism into the presidency. But instead, we have Trump, and the Democrats have, for as long as I can think, used the specter of a right-wing presidency as the reason to conform to the party line within the Democratic Party. Always the question of the lesser evil. For a lot of people, Trump would seem to be the greater evil that confirms that. Now, one could argue about that part, but are you concerned that in the Trump years ahead, that way of keeping people marching in line behind the Democratic Party is just going to be reinforced, because it seems to be confirmation that the Republicans represent this greater evil, and Clinton would be preferable, or anyone like Clinton, to a Trump, and hence there's no need for change, there's no need to do anything differently?
Well, that's exactly what we're seeing, right? And from, progressive luminaries like Michael Moore, now's the time not to, self-critique. Now's the time to, fight our Hitler in terms of Trump. And I think it's really the wrong approach. It's going to prove, I think, disastrous for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party for, 8 years from now. you can look back because there's, you know, a historical record. It was the DLC, this corporate wing of the Democratic Party, grew in power under Reagan. And it, by the time, you know, the Clinton was running in 92, it kind of had a stranglehold on the party. Now, these trends started sort of much earlier. And then it, what I'm getting at is that a lot of these trends, which drove the rightward lurch of the Democratic Party, kind of happened under the radar. I mean, neoliberalism really, you know, got its, started germinating in the party during the Carter administration. And then sort of, you know, grew undetected during Reagan time because everybody was fighting, you know, Reagan, you know, James Watt, the wars in Central America. And what was happening to, you know, the Democratic Party largely went unnoticed. And I think we're going to see this repeated. And one of the things that's already happening is that money from the Democratic billionaire class is going to be funding the resistance. So the Tom Steyers, the George Soroses, you know, the Warren Buffetts, all of this dark money is going to be controlling how the Democratic resistance to Trump behaves and how the party is structured for this battle that's going to take place over the next 2 and 4 years. And it's going to be a real challenge for the progressive resistance to separate itself and survive in this environment.
Well, let me end by asking you, on the one hand, clearly there are all these obstacles for the left, and you've indicated some of them looking ahead into the Trump era. What openings do you see?
Well, I think that the leadership vacuum in the party and the fact that we've got these sort of, you know, these old known figures creates an opportunity for the left that hasn't existed. And I believe firmly that, you know, our political movement we should follow trickle down politics on the progressive side, that things should come from the grassroots. And I think that these are going to be years of ferment. And I think that that's always good for building new movements and new leaders on the left. And there's a lot of breathing room, and there's a lot of opportunities for these new movements to grow. And my hope is that we'll see something like Jesse Jackson's old Rainbow Coalition of Black Lives Matter and the Chicano and Latino movements converging with the sort of the white-dominated Occupy movement. You know, the remainder of the Sandinistas joining forces with these other social movements that have really been abandoned by the Democratic Party. That's the hope.
You've written a lot about the environment. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about openings or places where you think that perhaps renewed social movements should focus their energies to do with protecting the environment, given the very naked politics of the Trump administration to be, which is dominated by executives from the fossil fuel industry.
I think one of the most hopeful things that has happened has been the Standing Rock protest. And, I mean, really out in the middle of nowhere to have thousands of people in the worst possible weather staying there, standing up, not being dislodged in the face of really brutal tactics. And that battle over a pipeline is one that can unify an entire swath of the country. Right. It wasn't just protests going on in North Dakota. You had similar protests in Des Moines, Iowa, from the same pipeline. And it's those kind of struggles give the opportunity for really diverse movements to unify. mean, my general view of, and critique of most social and political movements in the U.S. is that the farther away we get from the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, the more distant we are from the template that gave birth to the great political movements of the 60s and the 70s, the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement. All of those were really based on the kind of organizing template that went into the civil rights movement. And I think that the Standing Rock protests have maybe given us at least part of a new template from which we can mount a broader resistance to the forces that are looming under Trump. And I do think that the environmental movement cuts across economic and racial lines. And nobody wants a pipeline, natural gas pipeline, or a crude oil pipeline, you know, threatening their water supply or, you know, potentially exploding in their neighborhoods. And those are the kind of movements that can really potentially take off and bring us together in ways that have a lot of possibility.
Well, on that hopeful note, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with Jeffrey Sinclair. He's co-editor of Counterpunch and author of Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution. That's published by Counterpunch, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. His many books include the co-authored book Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.